this first safe drive up.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and listen to the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, which is in the Black Belt, and listen to the live stream there also. And you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or an auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always have interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook. And Time for an Awakening Media. The homepage is there. Chock full of new content, new podcast of several of the new programs, and also new content, new articles that you can download, share with your friends, along with some of the new podcasts of several of the new programs on Time for an Awakening. So check it out. Make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, we're expanding the discussion that we started last week, a critical discussion on integration, and adding to the discussion this evening is author and researcher, Miss Lorae Muhammad. The book, Black Integration, A Failed Social Experiment. And she'll be with us to expand the conversation this evening. And it should be an interesting one. We'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Not a Wu-Tanger. All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back. Time for an awakening, and before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and R Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Ellen.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I think this we're going to have an interesting discussion as far as continuing development, and I'm glad Sister Muhammad is really adding to this by the work that she's done in this area.
Before I talk about our upcoming guests, I did want to mention there's a couple things going on here in Philadelphia that kind of relates to this topic, to be honest. But we'll get to that later on if we get an opportunity doing before we end the broadcast. Mm-hmm. Several different things that hit the national news. But, Richard, when we started talking about this last week, I told you I ran across Miss Muhammad's book,
right?
Black Integration, a Failed Social Experiment. And I knew that I wanted her in the program to expand this discussion. I saw her book, and it's a critical analysis of integration. and she labels this as a failed social experiment. But it's a critical analysis, which we don't have. You know, we brought this up because when they had the 50th anniversary celebration of the murder of Dr. King, you've seen some of the veterans of the civil rights era and that civil rights movement, and they talk about the dream and things of that nature, but they don't talk about integration and a critical analysis of what it has done or not done for our people, the progress of it. These things need to be talked about in a critical analysis of our situation and moving forward. I'm glad that our guest tonight, with degrees in sociology, political science, and a master's in social work, author and researcher, the book, Black Integration, a Failed Social Experiment, Ms. Lorraye Muhammad is with us. Ms. Muhammad?
Yes, sir.
How are you?
I'm fine. I would like to thank Brother Richard and Brother Elliot for having me on this evening.
We're happy to have you join us.
Yes.
You know, Ms. Muhammad, and you know, sometimes I might call you Sister Muhammad. You don't mind, do you?
That's fine, sir.
Okay. Sister Muhammad, you know, when me and Richard talked about this subject last week, we kind of always kind of talk around it on Time for Awakening because all of the subjects we deal with talk about our experiences here, being it negative or positive, and most of them have been negative for our people. But when we introduced this topic last week, I told Richard off the air that I ran across your book, but I hadn't gotten it yet. I did get it yesterday, and I kind of perused the book. But I suggest to everybody to get the book, Black Integration, a Failed Social Experiment. You can go directly to Sister Lorraye Muhammad's website. You can go to Amazon, or I saw it also on Barnes & Noble. But pick up the book. It's a critical analysis of what we've been dealing with as far as this, as she labels it, a failed social experiment. And I want to get right into the conversation with you, Sister Muhammad. Your work and, you know, your years of experience in social work, your degrees in sociology and political science, what made you write a critical analysis of integration, and you labeled it Black integration, but tell us why you decided to go into this subject matter.
I went into this subject matter because when I was in college, I was considering joining the Nation of Islam. And during my desire to go into the Nation, I started doing all the research I could do on the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. In one of his books, Message to the Black Man, he states that integration would not work. And, I mean, the way he said it, he was so emphatic. It stuck with me in the back of my mind. And I noticed the date of the publication was only like 1974, 72, which means it was in the infancy of integration. So it always stuck with me, and I never, you know, I always wondered how things were going. And I worked in social services, which I retired from for 30 years, and I could see that there were some issues. So when I finished graduate school, I decided at some point I would write a book, and I said, you know what, maybe I should look at integration because now it's like 50 years later. So now you have the statistics that will demonstrate whether or not it's been successful or whether it's not, it's been a failure. So what I do is I use national statistics, and I use statistics that were gathered by the government. And so I'm using their own statistics to demonstrate that it has failed us.
Ms. Muhammad, you know, I think before we even talk about this subject, and I would advise some of our listening audience to introduce this subject in your social groups, your church groups, when you meet with your family. Talk about this in a critical fashion. Ask your family to bring any of the information that they can, because a lot of our people, when they talk about this subject or even subjects related, they do it from an emotional basis with no critical evidence to back it up. I would suggest that some of our listening audience start introducing this. Introduce this in your fraternity and sorority organizations, your church groups, your book clubs. Start talking about this. Ask the folks involved to bring evidence, whether pro or con, to whether this social experiment, as you label it, Sister Muhammad, has worked. I think what you have done, and maybe some of our people can get the book and use it as a yardstick. I think what you have done, you have taken critical evidence to back up your thesis, so to speak, or your hypothesis. But before we go into this, let's start from the beginning to kind of lay the groundwork. The society we live in, because as you talk about in your preface, our people have been here since this nation was a colony, basically almost since white folks have arrived here. And when this nation was formed, it was never formed for black people to be equals or even functioning people in this society. So using that as a basis, talk about integration, because you kind of state in your book, or you insinuate that during that civil rights era, I guess the late 50s or 60s, that this initiative was pushed. So do you see where it was approached at any other time during our experience here? Or do you see the manifestation of it was during the civil rights era?
From what I was young at the time, so it's all based on research. The people that were protesting the government, they were more concerned about getting freedom, justice, and equality. And instead, the government turned around and gave them integration because they had no intention on giving them what they requested. Separate but equal wasn't working because their idea of equal was you were in a shack, they were in a brick school. So when the request was made to make it separate but equal, meaning we both were in brick schools and we would take it, our people would be able to educate their children and you're educating your children, but it's equal because we have the same stuff. We have the same apparatus. We have the same textbooks. They were unwilling to do that, so instead they decided they would move us into the schools of the lower-income white people. Of course, we never integrated into the upper echelon of American society. The problem with this was that they were hostile to our arrival. It's like someone showing up at your house for dinner and you don't really want to see them there. So you know how you're going to treat that person because that person is treated as an unwanted or an uninvited guest. Then you mix that with the fact that most of them have a white supremacist mentality. So when you have a white supremacy as your ideology, you're definitely going to oppress whatever black person comes into your view because you have to ensure that white supremacy maintains itself. So even if the child comes into your class and the child is very bright, you're going to suppress that intellect because you don't want that child to overachieve and make the white children who are supposed to be smart appear not as smart as they say that they are. So we focus really, the government has really been complicit in the oppression of black people. And it's really sad to see everybody on television telling us to get out and vote when voting is not going to resolve the issue, when you're voting for a government that's run by psychopaths and sociopaths. And the reason why I'm saying this is because we have to remember slavery was a government program. Jim Crow was a government program. The crack epidemic was a government program. Mass incarceration was a government program. So which party are we going to vote for? Are we going to vote for the GOP that decided they would bring drugs into the communities in the 80s and sell the drugs to us to finance a war in Central America under the Reagan administration? Or are we going to vote for the DNC, which predominantly black people do vote for, but they use the situation to put mass incarceration in effect and to lock up all our men, which caused the destruction of the black community? So which party are we supposed to vote for? Because basically the government is establishing policies and implementing policies that are further destroying the black community. Because once you destroy the black family, the community goes the same way the family goes.
If I may,
go ahead, Richard.
Muhammad, I'm interested in how, as you approached this, you know, you came to reason why you gave us the reason why you did this. And as you were following the statistics, were there any kind of tangents, one, that you found yourself going into as you went through the government statistics to pull this together to make this comparison between then and now? Was it anything else that popped up that you were interested in or surprised about?
I really didn't focus too much on what happened then. What I was doing was looking at 50 years later. because integration has been in place for 50 years. So now I'm going to look at the current statistics and make a determination as to whether these government entities have vetted our situation as black people. So I really take the book from birth all the way through our life cycle, all the way to senior citizen, and looked at the statistics and made a determination as to whether we were better. And it came up that we have the highest rate of infant mortality. Our infant mortality rate is higher than some countries that are developing. We have a high infant mortality rate, higher than some developing countries. And so I went from birth, education, everything that we would interact with, every government agency, using their statistics to see how we fell behind the rest of the population. So that's how I was looking at it. I wasn't focused so much on what happened prior to 1960. I was more concerned with 50 years later. And if, because if you're doing a program, 50 years is more than sufficient for you to be able to implement that program successfully, if you really were interested in implementing it successfully. It shouldn't take you 50 years to get something done, because as anyone who's worked in government knows, or worked anywhere, when you're implementing a program, if you see there's some kind of deficits in that program, you make the corrections as you go along. You don't let the program go for 50 years and then say, okay, I'm going to, you know, there are things that I should have tinkered with. You tinker with that thing as you're going along. So any corrections that you need to make, you make those corrections so that the program becomes successful. But it seems to me as integration was never really meant to be successful, as it was meant to pacify the people who were angry about the situation that was going on in the 60s.
So is it unfair to say that, and I'm trying to, I know from based off of what you're saying, that you kind of were like looking at the numbers and then let the numbers speak for themselves in relationship to our condition as it is right now. Were you able to see who were in charge of those agencies who made those kind of decisions or didn't make those kind of decisions to do the kind of assessment as the program moved along, as the experiment moved along? Did you get to see that as you were pulling together the numbers?
Because it's really like I'm looking at national statistics, because when I travel around, I notice that when I watch the news, I don't care if you're in Detroit, New York, Philadelphia, Miami, wherever you go, you're seeing us as the people who are on camera being dragged off for whatever thing that they said that we did, whatever our transgression, legal transgression. So I'm looking at as a national, I said, well, how is this? This seems to me it's all connected and all related. So I'm looking at it from a more of a broad perspective, a national scope. So how I'm looking at it, if this is something that's going on nationally, I don't think that you can coordinate nationally unless you're in the federal government, how you're going to treat black people in your clinic or in your school. But I think one of the problems that we face is that because if I have a white supremacist mentality, that's going to translate into everything that I do. So if you're coming, because remember, we're closing our schools and we're going into their schools. We're closing our hotels and we're going into their hotels. So everything that we're closing down, we're now engaged more with the whites who we're coming in contact with. And so because we're coming in contact with them more directly, they always had access to us. But once we integrated, it was even more access. So now you're sending your children into a school where you can't protect them. And so whatever happens at that school, that goes with them through the course of their life cycle. And when we send our children in at kindergarten, at every milestone, we're losing children. So we have to look at what's going on in that school system and what's going on in this society that's destroying our people. It's not just a matter of us going into the institution, but what is the institution doing? I don't think that each individual school is going, okay, we're not going to train and educate black children. But I think more of it is that you don't train your competition. So if I'm going to be in front of your children and I know your children are going to be the ones who are going to be competing for a job with my children, how much vested am I in their outcome? Especially if I think that the fact that they're the other, they're not white, I don't think that they're worthy of what I'm going to give them anyway. So I think more of the problem that we face is that we're in a society where white supremacy is the ruling ideology. So everything that comes from it is an outgrowth of the white supremacy. Did I answer your question, sir?
Yes. Yeah. I See, I see. I agree with your, you know, the outgrowth, and I recognize that the way you were looking at it, the nationally. So, I'm satisfied with your response.
Mm-hmm. Sister Muhammad, the why? Now, this is a kind of sarcastic question, but I'm gonna put it out there because I want you to answer this. Why is it necessary to measure whether integration has worked for our people by using social indicators like you use in your book? Because, you know, I can look at TV and I see Oprah, I see Steve mm-hmm. Harvey, I've seen Obama for 8 years, and mm-hmm. that shows me that integration has worked, right? I mean, am I wrong? Tell me why social indicators has to prove whether integration has worked, and not my lying eyes.
Well, basically, when you're looking, the people that you're giving me as examples, they're all what we consider in sociology as outliers. Those are the people who fall outside of the norm. So anytime you're doing any kind of research, you have to look at the group dynamic. You can't cherry pick the ones you want to cherry pick and decide that the group is doing fine. Because you have the president, you have this. These are outliers, so they are not the entire group. You have to look at those millions of people and make an assessment based on the millions of people that you're looking at. So I think on some level, society would like us to think that things are going well because of the few, the twos and the threes and the fews that are doing well. But when I eat a sandwich, it doesn't fill your stomach. So the fact that I'm doing well doesn't have any impact on the people who are not doing well. So we have to look at the entire society, and based on that, we make an assessment as to whether integration is doing well or not.
Go ahead, Richard. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's one thing when you say that, because I've been listening to and following Julius Wilson's work as a sociologist, and the thing that he makes since integration has been that the one thing that has happened, that there has been a slice, tying to what you say, Elliot, has been a slice of Black people who have done better. And if you just look within the Black community itself, the social structure of the Black community itself, that a slice have done better, you know, not as good as white society, nowhere near, and for the mm-hmm. reasons that you laid out, Sister Muhammad, but definitely better than the overall percentage of Black people in general. And that there is now even sociologically a particular underclass that may never be able to be even have potential to be integrated or have opportunity within the structure because of their class structure. So what you say, and what y'all bring up about the people who are put in front of us, gives us no idea of really what's happening to the masses of Black people in general. And could you throw out some of these statistical indicators that you discovered that come to the conclusion that you did?
I am not actually permitted to quote anything from the book. When you publish with Amazon, they give you criterion for what you can and cannot do, and that's one of the things I can't do, as far as, like, tell you exactly what it says. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that we are not gaining as much as we could gain. But I think some of the issue is that when we talk about the underclass, we got to remember, in a capitalist system, it's because it's a capitalist society, everything is competition. We compete for everything. We go from competing for grades in school to competing on the workforce. So if you have that competitive thing going on, you're always going to have someone who does not make the cut. And one of the biggest things I noticed in school, which I always thought when I was a young person in school, elementary school, that you always can get these children who are struggling. The C students can be brought up to the A students, but there's not enough time given to the C students to bring them up to the A students. Well, what happens is, because they don't plan on doing anything with them in the future, they permit them to fall out of school. So I think because we're in the system of capitalism, and we know there's going to be winners and losers in capitalism, they don't mind the losses. But I think the mentality of Black people, we're more of a communal society. And because you want your entire community to develop and expand, then you have to focus your attention on everyone. We shouldn't have losses. We shouldn't be comfortable with people living in Penn Station. We should not be comfortable with people living on the side of the road. We should not be comfortable that people are spending so much money on rent that they can't afford food. So I think we would have to gravitate more to a communal environment so that everyone has a chance. So there's no such thing as an underclass. There's an underclass in America because they want an underclass in America. You always want to have that excess labor pool. So whenever you want somebody to come in and do cheap labor for you, then you have those people that have no job, so you can give them $5 an hour and they'll be satisfied with that. But I'm looking at a bigger picture, and my bigger picture is saying that no human person, no person should be wasted, a wasted resource. The reason why we don't have enough people curing cancer, all of the things that could be addressed in the broader society, we have people that could possibly do that, but we've decided that those people are insignificant. Just the fact that they knew 30 years ago there would be a shortage of nurses. They didn't go into these urban schools and train the children to be the nurse. Mm. They could have said, look, we know we're going to have a shortage. We give them scholarships. We get them up. We make sure that they're able to pass the exam, and we get nurses. But we've decided, no, it's easy to just to go brain drain another nation and bring them into America as opposed to developing the resources we have right here. So I think it's been an effort or an intentional to let there be an underclass. Just the fact that sometimes we create an underclass because of the education that people are receiving. You know that you can't advance yourself with a poor education. So if you're going to put the poor education systems in the black and the urban and poor areas, you're going to make your own underclass. I think that this society has spent too much time concerning themselves with the wealthy and not enough time concerning themselves with the poor. That's why we still have a poor person's movement, or we're worrying about the poor 50 years later.
You know, that kind of relates to the comment that you make in your introduction in the book, when you says that when the general population of America decided to integrate blacks into society, whites never intended to develop blacks to be their equals. So that's basically what you're saying, and you, yes. And you're backing it up with facts. Sister Muhammad, you know, in your book, you start going into different social structures to prove your point that this has never worked and never was intended to work. You start out with blacks in prenatal care. And I want you, I'm going to grab some of the social indicator topics that you raise and just have mm-hmm. you talk generally about them. Now,
yes,
your first topic was blacks in prenatal care, which relates directly to our women. Now, I pulled an article up, and I posted it on Time for Awakening website. And this is from Friday. And let me read just the first paragraph and kind of set you up, and you can take it from there. It says, here are reasons why black mothers and babies are in crisis, written by a sister by the name of Clarissa Hamlin. It says, for black mothers and mothers and soon-to-be moms, the rates of mortality in giving birth to black children are alarmingly high. There is a nationwide crisis that are affecting African-American mothers who are 3 to 4 times likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. According to mm-hmm. the Center of Disease Control and Prevention, black babies are also suffering. They are more than twice as likely to die as white infants. Simply put, a war has been waged on black mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that in relation. And it's kind of, like I just said, this article was just released on Friday. But talk about this in relation to the first chapter of your book.
I actually read that article.
Okay.
You're referencing. We are part of the unwanted population. We were wanted when we came here in 1555 as slaves. But ever since we became what they consider free, they've always counted how many black people are here. Now, the problem is now, demographically, white middle-aged people are dying at a high rate right now. They have one of the highest mortality rates in the country. Between them drinking themselves to death, drugging themselves to death, and committing suicide, the middle-aged white person have a high mortality rate. Now, factor in the fact that they have difficulty reproducing. This is an issue they have here and in Europe. There are whole towns in Europe that are empty because they are not able to reproduce. One of the reasons why Merkel permitted so many people to come into her country, I think she was permitting a million people come into her country, she explained, I think it was in the New York Times, that she didn't have enough people to operate her factory. So that's why she was permitting so many Muslims from different countries to come into her country. So because Europeans are having a hard time reproducing, and we have a hard time not reproducing, and there's going to be a demographic issue. So this is the reason why you see the policies that are going on in America right now. One of the policies of mass deportation. You have so many brown people coming in, and they come in and they have babies. Then you have black people. We're reproducing, so we have a situation where they have worse birth control in these prisons where you can get out early if you get sterilized, whether it's the male or the female. And even the police brutality, because for every black man that you kill at a young age, how many children that you kill, how many of his seeds went into the ground when he died? So all of these programs that we're looking at as isolated programs are really to counter the demographic shift, even the voter suppression. They're interested in suppressing the vote because the Democratic vote has the lock on the black community and the brown community. So the GOP is going, we got to do something or we'll never get into power. So we have to look at this as a bigger picture. It's not just a matter of these women losing their lives. It's like they're doing all these other things to make sure that we don't have a stranglehold as far as demographics. Because if we become the majority, then we're pretty much running the country. So that's the reason why we have such a high rate of death. I don't think that it's an accident, because all of these things that we're talking about result in a lower population amongst black people. And if they can save white women and their babies, why are they not saving black women and their babies? Now, I understand that we have a certain amount of stress that's more prevalent in black communities, and there's also issues with diet, because you might be in an area where you can't get the best food. But if the government was really concerned about saving these black babies, they would be putting in programs to ensure that these babies came to term. But there's not that will there, because these babies are babies that they consider to be undesirable. And the statistics bear out whether they're desirable or not, because if they were desirable, you would make yourself available to make sure that these children and their mothers survived.
You know, it's interesting to bring up Elliot and the response you have, Sister Muhammad, because I'm now looking, because y'all, the discussion is recently Serena Williams. Mm-hmm. She, her experience in the hospital as a black woman and trying to, and having her baby and the complications that she had in order, mm-hmm. and having to talk that healthcare team through. And mm-hmm. how to deal with her, if they didn't, she would have died. And I don't know if it would have had affected the baby, but in relationship to her, only because they didn't want to believe or listen to her as a black mm-hmm. woman. And I think we should infer that that's the reason why. If it was a white woman, they wouldn't have provided the same type of care. And I think that ties to both the points that you're making.
Sister Muhammad, the next one I want to focus in on was the blacks in the child welfare system, because, you know, for over 250 years when our people first came to these shores, we were property and merchandise, money-making merchandise for white folks. Now the situation has changed where we're not in physical chains, but the intention of making money off of our people is still always been here. It's always been the mentality of whites that have run this system and been partakers of this system. It's a part of white hegemony and definitely a part of this system of white supremacy. Talk about blacks in the child welfare system and how all of this relates.
I worked for about 20 years in child welfare, and I'm going to say Some of the things I've seen that went on in child welfare, I would have never thought that parents would do to their children. And that's black and white and brown, et cetera. But I realize that there's a lot of trauma because you can't treat people like cattle and not expect them to have trauma. So all of the things that we experienced under chattel slavery and Jim Crow, that's still there. And what happens is because you don't get the trauma counseling that you need, you have mental health issues on top of mental health issues on top of mental health issues. Now, of course, the person that's higher functioning will do better with their children, but those of us who are not as high functioning, we're not going to do very well when we have our children. Because it's like, if we, whatever we experience in our life that has an impact on us, and we internalize these things, and if you grew up in a world where everybody did a certain thing, if everybody drank themselves to a stupor every Friday night, that's your average expected environment. So that's what I'm going to do when I become an adult. So a lot of these things that we witness in slavery has passed down from generation to generation to generation. A lot of us are dealing, coping, because we never got the trauma counseling, obviously. We're coping using the substances, the drugs, the alcohol, the promiscuity, the overeating. All of that is tied to trauma. And they just said, okay, we're going to let you go, but no one sat us down and said, okay, we know that you experienced X amount of centuries of trauma. And no one tried to correct our situation because at the same time, the same people who traumatized us are the same ones who exploiting us by selling us alcohol, selling us drugs, selling us food. So they don't really have a vested interest in us being mentally well because there's so much benefit that they derive from our mental illness. Then you have to remember that we all experience most of us are still battling Stockholm Syndrome because we've been here for 463 years and we've been abused and we've been maltreated. And so we don't even acknowledge that we're captives. That in itself is a problem. But the reason why we have these issues with child welfare is because of what has happened to us. I was reading an article on Twitter and they were talking about the indigenous people in Australia and how their children were going into the child welfare system. So my response was this. Europeans come and they colonize you. Colonizing a person is a very brutal, violent experience. A lot of atrocities went on with the colonization. Then they know that they didn't give you any trauma counseling, so they turn around and they give you alcohol. They give you drugs. They give you all of these things that replaces what you need as far as counseling. Then because you get strung out on these drugs, they come and they take your children. But the people who cause the issue are the same people who come along and they become the ones that's going to help you. A lot of the times when I worked in foster care and I observed a lot of the children wouldn't go to counseling because the therapists were white. And these are young people under the age of 18. And so they understood they didn't want to counsel that it was white because they're the authors of the trauma. Mm-hmm. So we're living in a society that created the trauma, and then they penalize us for how we act out as a result of the trauma. So the reason why we have children in foster care is because of the trauma that we've experienced and we've never overcome, and some of us have never, I mean, we all are dysfunctional in just degrees of dysfunction. Because you can't live in a society that's this dysfunctional and not have some dysfunction.
Sister Muhammad, are you saying, you know, as far as your years of experience in this field and your research, that because, let me say this, most of our people don't want to acknowledge that they need mental help or even seek treatment for mental health. Now, are you saying that a necessary component into stopping this from being passed down to other generations is to receive mental treatment?
Yes.
Now, let me stop you there. Your answer is yes. So yes. We see clearly now why white folks is pushing legislation and getting legislation passed to help white folk, and that's who it's geared towards, white people dealing with this opioid epidemic. You see now that they're doing all these things to help bolster the family so this trauma is not passed down. They're even equipping police on the street with Narcan and other things that when they see somebody ODing that they can bring them back. So if that's a necessary component to somebody recovering, and blacks never had this, so it was never intended for our people to recover from this trauma. And it was always intended, from what you're saying, for our people to become mercantile property in this system.
Absolutely, because once you are functioning, then people can't exploit you. If you're a functioning person, there's less going on as far as you won't be interested in self-medicating, which is what they say in my field as a social worker. If you don't get the help that you need, you're going to cope the way you want to cope. Now, my coping might be going to the club every night and drinking myself and partying and, you know, picking up men, whatever. That's how I'm coping. My neighbor might be coping by doing something else. But we're all coping because no one ever came to us and said, okay, we know you've experienced a lot of trauma. Let's see what we can do to assist you. And so we're basically functioning the best we can. I'm going to be very honest with you. My perspective, all that we've experienced, the fact that we still can talk and function on any level is impressive. And so, but we have to recognize that we have some issues that we need to address. And in order for us to move forward, we're going to have to address those issues. We have plenty of people in the field who can work with us. We have a lot of black people in the field. I work with a lot of social workers who will be able to sit you down and help you. But the reality is they got to get past their own dysfunction, all due respect, because we all have something. But we have to acknowledge that it exists. We can't pretend as though nothing is going on, because the greater society is not going to help us. I remember as in the 60s when people were overdosing on heroin, we didn't even know they had Narcan. Think of all the lives that could have been saved if they had pulled this drug out and given it to our people. But they thought we were expendable, so they permitted us to pass away. But their people, they're willing to help. So we're going to have to come together as a community and to assist our own people to overcome these barriers, because no one's going to do it for us.
You know, on this particular subject, and I might be showing my bias, and I need y'all help on this, because in Pennsylvania, the state NAACP is trying to push legislation for trauma informed education. And when I heard that, and taking on what you're saying, Sister Muhammad, as far as recognizing that we are people who have really cope with trauma, but the classifying it really bothered me for the other reasons that you state. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the state would actually, even if they, and this is to place this in schools, because what they're saying is black children come to the schools as trauma victims. So the schools should be the first place of response in order to deal with these children and to assist. And and the schools, we are state institutions. But based off of your statistics, over the last 50 years, they haven't done. Why should we classify in a legislation ourselves being trauma victims so that we can be placed in another category, knowing that the institution is supposed to be addressing it? And education, as you also said, there's a lot of white teachers in the public educational system running black teachers out to be turned over, to turn these children over to them as their counselors to deal with this trauma. Something doesn't make sense to me in that. And maybe I'm just ill-informed or just being skeptical about that whole approach. So I accept what you're saying about trauma, but tell me what you think in relationship to pushing trauma-informed education to the public educational system based off of your work that you've done.
I have anything the government gets into, I have some concerns about, because we don't really know what their agenda is. I think it might be better that people who have done this kind of work would go in and assist the children who don't have an agenda, because we really don't know what their agenda is. And the reality is the person that caused the trauma should not be the person that fixed the trauma. It's like a person being assaulted in the street, and they go to the trauma counselor, and the person that's sitting behind the desk is the person that assaulted them in the street.
Mm.
So I'm a little concerned about that. We're gonna talk about some other things, I guess, later in the conversation, but we're really going to have to heal ourselves, and we're really going to have to heal our people and take that responsibility, because no one else is going to do it. No one else has that vested interest in the black community to help black people. So why would you send yourself into a situation where you know the person doesn't have your best interest at heart? I know I'm not going to sit and talk to someone who I'm kind of worried about what they're going to do with the information, how they're going to label me, if they're going to use this information appropriately, because they've really not been very helpful. And the only thing that I've seen they brought us here for is to be their pretty much cheap labor, slavery, because they really intended for us to be slaves forever. But their fighting over money caused it to come to an end sooner than they would have permitted, they would prefer.
Yes.
And after they freed us from slavery, we weren't treated well under Jim Crow. The only reason why they let the immigrants in, the European immigrants, is because they didn't want to pay up. So every program that they've implemented since our arrival has been to oppress us. So why would I think now all of a sudden in 2018 you want to be helpful? This is the same government that sold us crack. This is the same government that locked up all the men and women and children who were involved in sale of crack, who they brought into the community. So I can't trust that they're going to do the good thing all of a sudden out of the blue.
So would that say that, and I'm just pushing this because what you're saying brings to mind something we talk about also. Would that be the only institution that we have that might be able to address our trauma issues is our spiritual communities? Because we don't have individual, I would assume the number of clinicians that actually would make young people feel comfortable to go and get that kind of counseling expressed to deal with their trauma. The only place that we can go to that's an institution would be the churches and mosques, synagogues that are in the black community that are addressing black people as an institution to address black community's trauma. Would that, does that make sense?
I think that's probably a better option, because the person who you're coming into, whatever, whether it's the mosque, the synagogue, or the church, those people you already have a relationship with, and they can refer you to someone who they feel would do a good job with you. But you're going into school system, you don't know who's sitting on the other side. We found so many teachers have been putting up things on the internet which show that they're white supremacists. So you think this person is going to be a good fit for you? There's so many things that are coming out about people. You just can't trust that those people have your best interest at heart. It's better to get somebody who you know has your interest, because we all live in a small world. And when I was training my foster parents, I always told them, I said, I'm training you because I want you to do the best with these foster children, because these children are going to go out in the world. We can't insulate our children one from the other. So my child might meet your foster child in college or wherever where young people meet. So we can't assume that you can keep your children insulated from the rest of the world. So you want everyone to do the best they can with the children that they have, so that when we start mingling and marrying, there's as low trauma as possible. So I think that the school, I don't think they're going to do a good job. They're barely educating people. So now you're going to trust them now to give the therapy to?
Right.
I think with your suggestion of the church, the synagogue, the mosque is probably the best option. I don't think that they would be able to do that and teach.
Sister Muhammad, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, I want to play a clip by Martin Luther King in reference to the dream that he told black people about. And it's kind of an honest assessment of what he thought about what he did. I don't know whether a lot of our people are even aware of it. I know they don't push that narrative, because they always push the narrative of the dreamer and the 63 speech at the in Washington, D.C. But I want to play a clip in what he said in reference to the quote unquote dream to kind of fit the topic of what we're dealing with tonight, because that integration that was being pushed by some of the civil rights leaders during the early 50s, the late 50s and 60s, some of them now you see that they were pawns of the system, willing pawns, worked for the FBI, like Bayard Rustin and others, after redacted documents come out that they were FBI plants. But you had other men that were sincere in their efforts to integrate people into society. And when I use that term integrate, I'm not talking about making black folks so they can marry white people or socialize with whites. Most blacks didn't necessarily want that. Our people wanted equal health care or access to health care. According to your book, they wanted a quality education. They wanted better housing, and they wanted employment that they were previously denied. Some of the things that you attest in your book. So when we come back, I want to play this clip. I want to get you to expand on it, on what he said in reference to the thesis of your book. And then we're going to involve some callers, get some callers involved. Callers can get involved in this conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Get involved in the conversation with author and researcher Lorraine Muhammad, the book Black Integration, A Failed Social Experiment. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
In 1492, you came upon these shores. 700 years educated by the Moors. 17th century, genocide and the gun. Middle Passage blessed to market the Africans in the so-called lands of God. My kind were treated hard. From back then until now, I see and you agree. We have been a misrepresented people. From back then until now, just see my family tree. We have been a misrepresented people. We have been a misrepresented people.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. Just heard from Stevie Wonder. Misrepresented people. Tonight we're in conversation with researcher and author Larae Muhammad, the book Black Integration, a Failed Social Experiment. And before we go back to Sister Muhammad to get her involved in the conversation again, let me play a clip because, you know, white folks have put this narrative forth in representation of King in particular, because that's who I'm talking about. about him being a dreamer. They make sure our children understand and know about 63 and his speech, I Have a Dream. But listen to what he said 8 months before his death in reference to that dream that they keep pushing the narrative of. Because some of these later speeches, when he starts changing his mindset, are never featured. And they're never featured by people that work closely with him. Some of these other civil rights men that was his confidants. They don't push the narrative for reasons that it should be obvious. But let's hear his own words in reference to the quote-unquote dream. Let me see if I cue this up, and then we'll go back to our guests. Let me see here and get this together.
Mr. Chairman, friends and brothers in this first gathering of the National Conference on New Politics, ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me in the back? I don't know if the Klan is in here tonight or not, with all the trouble we're having with these microphones. We are the marchers from Mississippi and Selma in Washington, who staked our lives on the American dream during the first half of this decade. Many assembled here campaigned assiduously for Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Because we could not stand idly by and watch our nation contaminated by the 18th century policies of Goldwaterism. We were the hardcore activists who were willing to believe that Southerners could be reconstructed in the constitutional image. We were the dreamers of a dream. That dark yesterdays of man's inhumanity to man would soon be transformed into bright tomorrows of justice. Now it is hard to escape the disillusionment of betrayal. Our hopes have been blasted and our dreams have been shattered. The promise of a great society was shipwrecked off the coast of Asia on the dreadful peninsula of Vietnam. What happens to a dream deferred? It leads to bewildering frustration and corroding bitterness. I came to see this in a personal experience here in Chicago last summer. And all the speaking that I have done in the United States before varied audiences, including some hostile whites, the only time that I have ever been booed was one night in our regular weekly mass meeting by some angry young men of our movement. I went home that night with an ugly feeling. Selfishly, I thought of my sufferings and sacrifices over the last 12 years. Why would they boo one so close to them? But as I lay awake thinking, I finally came to myself, and I could not for the life of me have less in patience and understanding for those young men. For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. Amen. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set. The people cry for freedom, and the Congress attempts to legislate repression. Millions, yes, billions are appropriated for mass murder, but the most meager pittance of foreign aid for international development is crushed in the surge of reaction. Unemployment rages at a major depression level in the black ghettos, but the bipartisan response is an anti-riot bill rather than a serious poverty program.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and let's go back to our guest, Sister Larae Muhammad. Brother Richard.
Yes.
That was that speech from the Association of New Politics 8 months before he was murdered, and he talked about how his dream became a nightmare for black folks. His own words, not me assessing it. Sister Muhammad, talk about that portion of his speech, what he said in reference to the dream that people keep talking about, what he said in reference to it, and why. He mentioned something there that some of our people, and might go over some of our people's heads, the listening audience, Time for Awakening, might be a little bit different. But when he said that he got our people, and he was talking about other blacks, to have faith in a people that are totally unfaithful. He was talking about this white government. Mm-hmm. It's nobody else. It wasn't blacks, wasn't in control. So he basically said that this dream that he got the people to buy into was a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted you to expound on that in reference to, because listen, he is the face of integration during that period. He's the one that is out front. He was the front man.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead. You can say something, and then I'll bring some callers involved. Go ahead.
The way I'm looking at it, he had to recognize at some point that the whites had the control and we didn't have any control. So they would have to be agreeable to whatever he wanted to get from them in order for it to come to pass. So if they're not agreeable to it, then it basically is not going to happen. And I think that Dr. Martin Luther King is one of the most misrepresented leaders in modern times, because at the time he was here, they hated him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because basically, the only black leaders that white America trusts are the ones that they control and the ones that they handpick. The only other leaders that they like are the ones that they've already killed, and now they're martyrs. They don't really like black leadership unless they are the ones they're controlling that black leadership. And they weren't controlling him, or they couldn't control him, even though they were blackmailing him and doing all manner of things to him to try to get control of him. But I think he saw that they were not going to live up to their end of the bargain, that they weren't going to give him what we needed as a people at that time. That's how I read what he's saying.
Go ahead,
before you go to a call, Elliot, because I wanted to see how y'all respond to this. In the sense of, do you think that it's that not just the leadership, recognizing white society, white government, the leaders of white government is never going to include or integrate us. That's a given. History tells us that. Do you think that for the question of integration, that the boomer age group, which they say is from 1955, born in 1955, who lived through the civil rights or the integration period, did we fail in understanding what Dr. King's message and that Elliot played actually meant? Did we fail that? Because it seems that, yes, there were people who were placed into government, but we as a group who lived through it, we seen the drug epidemic. We seen the educational failure. We seen the political misrepresentation. We seen the health disparity. And did we still hold on to? And it may be a rhetorical question. Did we still hold on to the integrationist ideal in spite of seeing all this that was around us and making other choices?
Well, we basically had to make a choice. I was young, so it's hard for me to say the thinking totally of the people that were surrounding him, but I think that they did what they could, and what they tried to get what they could out of them, but at the end of the day, America has decided that they don't want black people to integrate with them, because really it's not integration, it's assimilation. We can never assimilate because we're black. And I can, as long as I can pick you out, see, a person that can come here from Canada, they're white, they come in, you know, they do what they have to do, they get a job, they're white. But America never really intended for black people to have that type of role. They always wanted America to be 85% white. They always wanted black people to be their servants. And they don't care whether you're serving at a higher rate or a lesser rate, but as long as you're a servant, because it doesn't matter how much they're paying you, at the end of the day, they view you as the help. So there was never going to be a time where they're going to let us integrate with them the way, I guess, people, I think everybody has a different perception of it, but they never were going to let us come in and be their equals, because that's not what they brought us here for. The agenda hasn't changed since 1555. The agenda still remains the same. As a matter of fact, we're a nuisance now because we're producing too many babies, and they're thinking they're going to outpopulate us. So now they have to deal with us another way. But I don't really think that we failed so much as people were more trusting. People thought maybe that it was going to work. I think there was a lot of things going on in that play, and it's only 50 years hindsight that you can see really that it wasn't going to work. But when you were in it, I don't necessarily think that they thought it was going to be a problem. I think they felt as though, okay, maybe after all of these years, they're going to be nice now, and they're going to let us go to school, and they're going to let us do whatever it is that we're going to do. But if we're looking at it 50 years later, we see that that's not really what happened. I mean, who would have thought that your own government would sell you drugs? I mean, it's just something that no one would, I don't think, conceptualize until after it's already happened.
And, you know, in hindsight, I think that some of our people, as bright as some of them were, they didn't really historically analyze Europeans, because if they did, then they would come to the conclusion that the Native Americans did, and they only had a brief interaction with them.
Yes.
When they said, this man is a liar, they might have used another term, but that's basically what it meant. But let's go. Let's get some other. Let's go to 267. 267. 267.
Yes, Brother Richard.
Yes,
Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
How are you, sister? I admire what you're saying, and I want to read your book. Is your name Lorraine or Lorraine Muhammad?
Lorraine.
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 Oh, very good. Very good. Sister, when I came in the nation, I didn't come in this wearing a bow tie and a shirt and suit, or the one wearing a dashiki or African garb. I came in the nation first as a popular writer and a popular reader of Elijah Muhammad. So I came in reading, and first two books I read before even joining the nation was How Do You Live, 1 and 2, the third one was Minister to the Black Man. And the learned brothers amongst me said to me, one thing I think you should do in all of our study groups is look up the word integration. Mm-hmm. And if you come across a lot of brothers who've been around, a lot of them would know what the word integrated mean or integration meant. And like you're saying, integration, dealing with the quality of people that you're dealing with. And what is the quality like? In other words, these people are not looking at you as their equal to connect or combine or get together with you as a whole. They're not looking at you like that. And Elijah Muhammad, and I like what you said about the message to the black man, because he has a chapter on integration. And in that integration, he highlights on King immediately as the head of the group and trying to force yourself on the white man against his nature and his will. And at one of the paragraphs, he specifically talks on James Meredith, the poor fellow, trying to force himself into a school where it is 100% white, and they are telling him they do not want him there. And the army is standing around him to force him in there. What a crazy idea. And then he gets to doing it to their schools, their restaurants, and their businesses. And we did have our schools, we did have our restaurants and our businesses, and we did have a bank called the Guaranteed Savings Bank. So I'll tell you this, sister, that this message then was great, and this message now is good. But you have some people to take the position that King wasn't an integrationist. He was fighting for the laws. Well, I'm going to say to you, sister, they have a young man walking down the street. They shoot him in the back. And you find out later, it's a cell phone. They have one young man. They shoot him. They claim he had a gun. It's Skittles. So what laws are we fighting for to make us equal with them? He will never see you as his equal. And the messenger had gave us a blueprint and a plan. Now, like I said, as a popular writer and as a reader, I came in the nation reading before becoming a member. And I think that's how a lot of Elijah Muhammad's followers or nationalists or people part of the black Jews were wrong. You don't come in following. Come in reading, learning, and understanding. So, sister, I'm going to get your book. But I'm going to say this, that the way that they shot King down like a dog, the worst part about it is Harry Belafonte had to bury him. He had no money. As much as he sacrificed for the people, he had no money. You got a good host, Elliot. She needs to come back.
Thank you for your call, brother.
Peace.
You know, before we went to break, Sister Muhammad, you mentioned about assimilation. And I think that our people, in some of their minds, they wanted integration. But whites wanted assimilation. And they're two different things. Talk about it from the perspective, because we can see that the laws were set up. Now, let me say this first, because you had a chapter on housing. I want to get to employment, and I want to get to the military, because you said some interesting things in regards to the military. But let me read this thing on housing first. This come out of the New York Times, and it was in Saturday's paper, Saturday's New York Times. Let me read this. I'll just read a couple paragraphs. It says, blacks still face redlining on housing. It says, for generations of white American families, home ownership has been a fundamental means of accumulating wealth. Their homes have grown in value over time, providing security in retirement and serving as an asset against which they can borrow for education or other purposes. But African Americans were essentially shut out of early federal programs that promoted home ownership and financial well-being, including the all-important New Deal mortgage insurance system that generated the mid-20th century home ownership boom. This missed opportunity to amass wealth that white Americans took for granted is evident to this day in a yawning black-white health gap and worse, a black-white wealth gap and in worse health, living conditions, education opportunities for African Americans. The Fair Housing Act, which turned 50 years old last week, ended the most egregious forms of discrimination and brought a modest rise in black home ownership. But those gains and hard-won wealth they represented were wiped out a decade ago in the Great Recession, which reduced the African American home ownership rate to levels not seen since housing discrimination was legal in the early 60s. So we see again, it's almost like a dangling a carrot. You think you're gaining, but the rug has been pulled out. And this is just an example of all of these social indicators that you list in your book. It's the same thing. You think you're gaining, but then you look and you're back in the same spot that you were 50 years ago. So just as you state, and it's a critical analysis, that whites living in white society and the powers that be, that are the gatekeepers of white supremacy, never intended for blacks to be integrated into this society and never wanted blacks to be integrated into society.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to kind of throw that out there in relation to that chapter on housing that you talk about. But let's go to employment, because we see now that this administration is touting black unemployment is lower than it's been in years. And if you look at it, since they've been keeping figures, I think in the early 70s, mm-hmm. blacks have had almost double-digit unemployment for almost all of that time, which is devastating to anybody, I mean, to a country's economy. If white folks mm-hmm. had 1 year of double-digit unemployment, they'd be screaming bloody murder. Blacks had almost 40 years of consistent double-digit 10% or more, and in some of these cities it's 16% of unemployment. That's devastating to a family and to black generations, not a family.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that now in relation to this 7.8 or whatever, because I think it jumped a couple percentage points since the beginning of this year. Talk about that in relation to what they're talking about, because on the ground, now I'm on the ground in these cities.
Mm-hmm.
If blacks have a job, it's two and three jobs in order mm-hmm. to make a living wage. It's never one job where you can take care of your family. It's two and three jobs, and you're still struggling to have a living wage. Talk about that in relation to the chapter in your book, Sister Mohammed.
In order for us really to have stable employment, we're going to have to become entrepreneurs and hire each other, because it's easy to get a job. The hard part is to get them to pay you anything. You can all go and get a job. But will you be able to live with the job that they're going to give you? And are they going to pay you what you need in order to sustain yourself? That's just the reality. And as you did say, our unemployment rate has always been double the white unemployment rate, like you say, since the 70s. But they don't even count the people who no longer are looking for a job.
Mm-hmm.
That's why that figure of whatever they're throwing out this week, 7.5, that's just the ones who are still actively looking. Once you stop looking, you no longer are counted in their statistics. So the mm-hmm. rate of unemployment is always higher than what they state the rate of unemployment is. Just like the homeless rate is always more than what they state. Because if you're living with a cousin, you're not considered homeless. If you're living with your aunt, you're not considered homeless. So even if you're sleeping on the couch, you're not considered homeless. So when we're looking at these statistics, we got to remember that sometimes the statistics are skewed. And the problem with the housing issue was when they decided they were going to sell everybody and their mother and the dog and the monkey a house, they created an artificial market, an artificial real estate market, which drove the prices of the homes up. A lot of these real estate agents knew that these people who they were selling homes to could not afford a home. Instead of pre-approving them, and you find out that you can afford X amount of house, whether it's $100,000, $200,000, whatever your price range was, they just were selling them homes and telling them, oh, you can move in a tenant. They were telling them all kinds of things in order to sell the home. That created a problem, because at some point, those people were not able to maintain themselves. And the people that were not able to maintain themselves, then they got victimized by the banks, because the banks weren't trying to give them what they call a home modification. So they might have put their last dime into getting this home, and then what ended up happening, those people lost their home, were not able to get a modification, and all the money that they sunk into the home was lost. So it was like a great big banking scheme. And instead of the federal government giving money to support the families who really were injured by this situation, they gave the banks, who caused the situation, the bailout. So every time they have a policy, the policy is always, or when they implement a policy, it's to the benefit of the wealthy, to the detriment of the poor. Because a lot of these banks, the only reason why there was this one bank who I'm going to remain nameless, the only reason why they were giving modifications was because they were scared the Justice Department was going to come after them. I'm just telling you what was stated by the workers. Because some of them got bailout money knowing that they themselves were in jeopardy. So when they got the bailout money, they got it under false pretenses. But they went and they bailed those banks out. But how many people lost homes? How many people lost housing, lost all of the money that they ever had into this house? It might have been only $10,000, but $10,000 is a lot of money for a person to put in their last $10,000. So these people, they always have some kind of scheme to loosen the money from your pocket to the benefit of what they want. So we're always at the short end of the stick. So in order for us really to get what we need out of for ourselves, we have to have self-determination. We have to realize that most of our problems will be solved with just our unity. We don't have the luxury at the situation that we're in 2018 to be nitpicking over whether you go to the mosque and I go to the synagogue, or if you go to the synagogue and I go to the church, or if I'm in the Baptist church and you're in the Methodist church. We have to come together for the sake of our future, for the sake of our present children and the children that are coming down the line. We cannot continue to live as we're living, because you can see the impact of what their policies are doing when you walk the streets of New York, when you walk the streets of Philadelphia, when you walk the streets of Detroit. Wherever you at, black people are the ones who are getting the short end of the stick. So if we really want to save our communities, we have to unify. We have to tie our ropes together and stop worrying about who this one is with this one, this one's with that one. I don't like Firefly. I don't like this one. We don't have the time for that. We have to link up ourselves, bury our situations, our little petty grievances, and realize that we're not going to survive this if we do not unify. We're not going to survive this if we don't understand our... Even if it's you, because at some point we're going to find out that we have more in common than we have not in common. We have more in common than we do have differences. That's the words I would like to use. But we have to, for the sake of thy Lord, we have to save ourselves. We have to save our children. Because no one else is going to do it. As we're speaking now, they're talking about what they're going to do with food stamps and whether they're going to give me boxes now and give people boxes. They always got some scheme, but all of the schemes that they give to us, none of them are really beneficial to us. So they're always going to be ahead of us because they're going to put themselves first and put us second, third, fourth, fifth, depending on how they're thinking about what they're going to do. We have to put ourselves first.
Wow. Let's go back to the phone. Let's go to 678. 678.
Good evening, Brother Richard. How you doing there, Brother Elliot? How are you? Liam Harris.
How are you, sir?
How you feeling?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Wonderful conversation. I had got your email earlier today about the show, and I wanted to call in. I'm listening to the sister. I'm really enjoying what she said. I haven't purchased the book yet, but I do plan to do so. But I wanted to add something to the conversation and even ask the author, maybe she might have used this resource. To do so. One of the things that I found in doing historical research is that obviously we know that white historians have always attempted to downplay our efforts and to always look at the African agenda in a very mushy, dilapidated way. That's well known. But one of the things that I have found that is a good primary resource that can kind of let you know what the agenda was for a lot of us and a lot of our leaders, during those early years, was a collection of the minutes and the agenda of an organization called the Colored Convention Movement. This was something that the historian Dr. Bale, Howard Bale, pulled together. There were many, many conventions throughout America beginning during the years of the antebellum period, beginning in 1830, going all the way into the 20th century. And these conventions were pulled together every year to write agendas for our community, action plans, mm-hmm. Things that could be done to make changes. One of the very first ones was done right there in Philadelphia.
Yes.
At Mother Bethel Church. Richard Allen was appointed the president back in the 1830s. And if you were to look at those agendas and look at the minutes, you would see that most African-American leaders didn't want integration. That's not what they wanted. As mm-hmm. a matter of fact, the agenda item for that one in Philadelphia in 1830 was to talk about pulling together a movement to go to Canada, an immigration to Canada, to get away from some of the crazy. Mm-hmm. I think where the integration idea came in, which was in the more toward the 20th century, was through the process of the education. You know, it wasn't so much that blacks wanted to just go to white schools, but Howard, the brother that the predecessor to Thurgood Marshall, Charles Hamilton Hughes, when he went through the South and photographed those schools, we have to really look at a picture of those schools. Those schools had roofs that were leaking. There were no lights in there.
Mm-hmm.
There was no heat. Those kids could never have learned in a condition like that. So the idea then was to integrate into the white schools where at least the conditioning would be better to learn. So in closing, I just want to say that I wanted to ask her, first of all, did you ever take a look at that color convention movement minutes? To kind of look at what some of those leaders in the 1830s, 1870s, 1880s, some of the things that they were proposing for change in the black community. And if you did, I'm sure you would have found that most of it wasn't integration. They did not believe in that. You know, so I'll throw that out there.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Rogers, for your contribution. Sister Muhammad, a comment on
I would have to agree with what he said, because I believe that a lot of the people who came before the leaders, they really weren't looking for integration. They were looking for equality. And what they gave us was integration. That's what they were comfortable with it. They didn't want to give us the same schools they had, so they decided we'll just move them into our schools. But the problem with that was the hostility that the children met when they went into those schools.
Yep, that's right.
Another example to that is the National Equal Rights League of 1864, which they try to equate that with the civil rights, you know, but it wasn't asking for civil rights. It was asking for equal rights, and therefore not necessarily about integration, but more about being able to have equal access under the law, which was not social custom wouldn't allow.
And let me say this before I let you go, Dr. Rogers, and you can comment on it too, Sister Muhammad, is that the thing that we notice, get a little interference in the background. Okay. The thing that we notice, because myself and Brother Richard highlighted a document on Time for Awakening right after the Civil War, Lincoln sent representatives of the government to meet with leaders, black leaders at that time. And I was kind of surprised because I had never read a minutes of any meeting of that nature. I think it was 30 black leaders right at the end of the Civil War to ask them what they wanted. I guess that was his way of kind of thanking them for helping them win the war, helping the Union win the war, asking them what they wanted. And almost by a man, I think you, and Richard, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Out of those 30 leaders, I think only one suggested that he wanted to work with Europeans. The majority of them said that they wanted to be left alone.
Right.
But the thing that made it hard, and I want you to comment on it, especially Sister Muhammad, because you looked at some of the statistics. Excuse me. That when I think the income tax was implemented in the early 1900s, if I'm not mistaken. Anybody can correct me.
1913.
Okay. Something. Now, when that is implemented and blacks are in society and you take their money and use it towards white interests and don't address any needs of blacks, then that becomes a problem. I think that's what a lot of if there was no income tax and black people just move around society, then we could become and do the things that we need to do and not worry about those people. But when they were taking our money, the wages that we had and taking it as an income tax and then using it to help their schools, to help their hospitals, to better white society at the expense of ours, then it really became an issue. Sister Muhammad, can you reflect on it from that perspective?
Yes, that is a problem, because if you're taking my tax, it's just like taxation without representation. And what am I getting for my tax dollars? But more importantly, we had already invested so much free labor into this country. This country wouldn't be what it is if it wasn't for black people.
Okay.
We were the first commodity on Wall Street. Almost all ports were bringing in slaves. They made so much money off slavery in and of itself. A lot of, if you research a lot of these commercial banks, their money came from slavery. So there's a lot of things that wouldn't go on in this country if it was not for slavery. So we already had invested, even if we had never paid a dime in taxes. If you had 10 people working for you for 10 years for free and giving you their wages, you know how much money you would have? Now you translate that into millions of people over centuries. I always say that the enslavement of black people was America's get-rich-quick scheme, because they got very rich at the expense of us and, of course, the Native Americans, who they slaughtered to take their land. So even if we never paid a dime in taxes, they already had made so much money just on our chattel slavery. So they owe us more than they would ever be willing to pay us. So the fact that they want to give us a school, that's nice. But I think that we owed a lot more than they were ever going to be willing to give us. Every time you talk about reparations, you get people very upset, because they understand that they built the entire Western civilization on the backs of other people, whether that's here or abroad. Because basically, once they started circumnavigating the globe, everywhere they went, they stole. I used to say they stole everything not nailed down, but it's one of my colleagues is claiming that it was a country that they did take some stuff that was nailed down. So, that being said,
Dr. Rogers, I want to thank you for sharing with us this evening. I'm looking forward to Black Reality Think Tank on Tuesday night.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you very much. Enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Talk to you later. Let's go to 646. 646?
Yes, good evening to you and your guests. Number one, you had spoken earlier in regards to integration and the Oprah Winfrey's and the Michael Jordans and the rest. The funny thing is that no one never makes an honest analysis when speaking about that. The fact of the matter is, that's just a few.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put forward the percentages of black so-called billionaires and Yoruba billionaires, there's absolutely no comparison to the data or the numbers. And I don't understand why we as a people do not honestly address that and even deal with it in terms of those numbers and how, you know, we really don't participate in that economic, you know, dynamic. Because if we continue to make it seem as though we compete in that economic dynamic, then we've just fooled ourselves. So that right there has to be something that honestly needs to be addressed, because the reality is this. The chances of one becoming a millionaire or a billionaire is slim to none, and not truthfulness. So the thing is, I believe we as a community have to figure out how we can economically sustain ourselves in this racist country.
Mm-hmm.
To the point to where as we can build institutions so that once we build these institutions, we as a people could move forward into some form of ownership, some form of being able to maintain a family structure, or anything that will allow us to survive in this country and not totally, in all honesty, be extinct. Because it seems like that's where we are honestly heading towards in this country, is extinction. Mm-hmm. Because they're killing us at will, and any time they deem it necessary to harm us physically, they mm-hmm. get away with it. And there's no repercussions whatsoever for that type of genocidal behavior towards our peoples, you know? So my question to you is, you know, what could we honestly do to change the narrative that we are integrated into a society that, in all truthfulness, don't even have no more damn use for us?
That's right. Should I can answer now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Okay. I'm going to be very, the only thing I can see that we can do is to separate from them. Because as long as they have the authority over us, they will do with us what they will. We have to unify as a people. We have to set down our petty grievances. We have to decide that we want to live. In order for us to live, we have to resolve our issues. We got to pull our resources. And we got to decide we cannot stay here anymore. We have to realize that enough is enough. But as long as we have that idea that one day they're going to treat us better, we'll never leave. We have to recognize this is as good as it gets. They're going to constantly be killing us. They're going to be constantly put in a situation like Flint, Michigan, where the water we're drinking is poisonous. They just found out Chicago's water has all kind of poisons in it. That was in, I think, today. I read that in Twitter, an article. So we're going to have to remove ourselves from the hostile environment. It's like if you had a friend, and every time she went home, her husband beat her up. The first thing you would say to her when you pulled her to the side, you need to leave him. That's what you would be saying. We've been a victim of American society for 463 years, and the whole time we've been here, you could not probably list one day when we were not being maltreated in some way. They did not bring us here to be their equals. They didn't bring us here to be their friends. We have to recognize what it is. We have to get over our Stockholm syndrome and our connection to our captors, and we need to move on.
Okay, now I agree with everything that you're saying, but my only question to you is this. When you say separate, where the hell are we going, and how the hell are we going to be able to maintain ourselves in that separation?
That's a legitimate, sir, that's a legitimate question. But let me say, put this in your ear. We lived trillions of years before Europeans. We didn't always live with Europeans. We didn't start living with them until the Berlin Conference and the transatlantic slave trade. The reason why they came to what you call Africa now, which is really West Asia, to get us is because we were the best educated people in the world.
Right.
So they didn't just go up willy-nilly and just grab anybody. They grabbed the best educated to build their society. So as we build this society, we can build our own society. As far as separation, we don't even have to leave this particular landmass. At some point, it's going to become obvious that we cannot coexist, and we're going to have to remove ourselves. Now, the removal will be voluntary because you have white people that don't want us here either. Because they recognize, let me finish this, they recognize that it's a problem. So at some point, it's going to be they're going to realize it's mutually beneficial that we no longer live with them. The biggest problem we're going to have is mentally, can we think of a world outside of living with them?
That's the problem.
That's the biggest hurdle. Because
yep.
we got so used to their more ways and their folk ways,
yep.
and we don't remember what it was when we lived before them. We have to re-educate our people so that they can move on. We do not have to live with them. We only here because there was no one else to build their civilization but us.
I know all that. I'm just saying, when we start the process, Where do we go?
She don't have those answers, Jay. But
how do we start the process today? What's the best way to start it?
The first thing we need to do is stop following everything that they do. A lot of these things that we spend money on, all of these holidays, a lot of us don't even know where we got those holidays from. A lot of those holidays that they put under the Christian church are really pagan holidays. So we're spending money we don't have to get trees that we don't even understand what the tree is for. We're spending all of these money following behind what they do, their mores, their folk ways. These things are not something that we brought to this country with. So we have to first remove a lot of that stuff, that stuff that we're doing that we didn't do before we came here. So that's one of the separations. It's the mental separation that's first, then the physical first separation will come after that.
Right.
Okay.
I got you. Thank you, and listen, I'm going to get your book. I totally agree with everything that you're saying, and I guess we just have to figure out how we're going to start the process and, you know, just move forward, because Ishirugu, he's not going to never treat us in the manner that we assume he's going to treat us, because like Hakeem Adebuti said, and the sad thing is, he changed his mind about this. They are our perpetual enemy. Have a good night.
Jay, thank you as always for your call, man.
And if I, this gives me an opportunity to you know, Sister Muhammad and Elliot to kind of, because Jay's question is really always valid. And one thing I think that we kind of also say is that we also have to look at that a lot of those systems or people who have those associations are already in place, right? They may, Sister Mama, you mentioned about the Nation of Islam. Well, that's a value system and a social social economic organization that's already in place. So we don't have to we don't have to become members of it, but we don't have to say that nothing is taking place. And things that, when we're talking about partnership or getting over our differences, then we're talking about, well, how do we, who might not want to become members, can be able to create relationships and trade in order to make that system stronger and our system stronger, looking at things that are already there. And I think that's where would be the first step, is that our narrative move towards what are systems that are already in place that has historical references that are already there, some weak, some stronger. But we may need to have, as Dr. Rogers said, where we have these conventions, which there are some already taking place, where these different delegates will come together and discuss not just strategies of overcoming, dealing with our outside, as Brother Jay say, perpetual enemy, but strategies of how do we trade with each other? How do we strengthen our employment? How do we strengthen our healthcare system with each other? What resources do we have? We have to come together and look at what we got. And that's what the point that you made that I think is really powerful and important, that we have the creative genius to come up with something unique in relationship to the hostile environment that we're in that can be sustainable and defensible. But we got to also move from always looking at those who aren't doing to those who are doing, not looking at those who will do, like what white supremacy as a system does, and looking at what system that we need to put in place that can be defensive, that can be and supportive, and that we can be able to put in place. And we've done that even in chattel slavery. I mean, the Maroon societies, IT, you know, that's a national, they fought against that and won. So we ain't got to come up like we don't have no history about this. We just got to look at, as you did in your book, look at the present condition and say, okay, these are the things we got to do. I just had to put that in there. I apologize.
That's not a problem, but we really have to link up together like yesterday, because the reality is that most of the American budget is going to go to war. Mm-hmm. And so if they're spending their money on war, they're not going to have any money for the programs that a lot of us are dependent on. So we're going to have to get together quickly, and we're going to have to start addressing our issues in order for us to survive. That's just the bottom line.
Yeah,
and pressure makes diamonds.
You're absolutely right.
You said pressure makes diamonds.
Let's go to 267. 267.
Hey, good evening, Elliot, and good evening, Richard. And I want to say good evening to your guests.
How are you, sir?
All right, now, I just had to ask one question. I mean, I was listening to the conversation, and I heard the sister say that Africa's West Asia, and I often heard the term Asiatic black man, but I never found the literature to justify those terms. Could you let me know exactly where that come from, who came up with those terms, so I can be, I've heard Akiba Land, which I've found some historical documents on that. I've heard Kush, and other terms, but never, I've researched a lot, and I've never heard of the continent being called West Asia, or people call Asiatic black people. So okay. Could you let me know exactly where those terms come from, please?
The term West Asia is from the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. We have to recognize that a lot of the research that we're doing is from information that is current. A lot of the history that we have predates European history. But we do know that it wasn't named Africa until the Berlin Conference, because the Berlin Conference is when they decided who was going to get what as far as Europeans are concerned. They named Africa after a white man. And you can research and find that that is actually the case. The Berlin Conference, when they divided up Africa, they renamed all of those countries to different names that they wanted to name them. Nigeria, that's why when you go in to get these blood tests to find out who you're related to, and they're telling you, oh, you're from Nigeria. Nigeria didn't even exist when we were kidnapped and dragged here. So all of these countries that have the names that they have now, those names are the names that the Europeans gave it. And I do know, I spoke to a Nigerian brother who said that that name wasn't, Africa wasn't called Africa at that time. But I don't know if he knew the exact name of it at that time. But the Honorable Elijah Muhammad taught us that it was called West Asia prior to the colonialization of the continent.
Oh, you never heard of the term Akibaland or Kush?
I did hear that. I did
okay.
hear
because I don't call it the continent Africa either. But I was just trying to figure out where does it, and you just let me know exactly where it came from. It came from the teachers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So that's my question answered right there. I always just wanted to know where else could I research this to find out where we were called these things, and you just explained that to me. And that's basically all I had to do. I just wanted to ask you that one question. I don't believe in that term Africa either. I have a very bad problem with that because I do believe that it was called something else before then. I don't, you know, but a lot of people want to call the continent Africa, and, you know, I allow them to do that. But I heard you call it West Asia, and I heard Asiatic black man, and I have done some research on this, and the only place I can find those two terms is from the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. So that's all I had to do. I just wanted to ask that one question. All right. Thank you, and I'll continue listening. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for your call. Let's go to 484.
Good evening.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Great. This is Dr. Payne. How are you doing? I promised I would call you. I will call in. I just have some questions for Sister Muhammad, if you don't mind.
Yeah. Oh, no. Go ahead.
To be on with you. I'd like to ask you about people like Shelby Steele and Larry Elder and Armstrong Williams. These are African-Americans who have hostility toward African-Americans, and they are placed in the media, they're placed in the forefront there, and they're greatly rewarded for those attitudes. What is your opinion on people like that?
Usually what I say about that is this. We've been here for 463 years. Many of us have Stockholm Syndrome. And when you've been in captivity for 30 days, they say you can have Stockholm Syndrome. So what do you think happens if you've been here for centuries? And people say, well, I don't have Stockholm Syndrome, but you put on a uniform and you go across to another part of the world and you're killing people who've done nothing to you at the request of the people who kidnapped you. So sometimes we have mental health issues then we don't realize we have them. And then you have people who are willing to exploit those things. If you're willing to, you know, sell yourself for whatever trinkets you're going to get, then it speaks for itself. But I think a lot of it, some of the people actually believe what they're saying, because we've been indoctrinated with white supremacy. If you've been indoctrinated with white supremacy, you've also been indoctrinated with black inferiority. And some of us want to link up with the superior, or what they perceive to be the superior, and join forces with them to do whatever. But some of them are just opportunistic.
Excellent answer. I also want to ask you about, it was a recent article on Europeans being related to the Neanderthal blood. and mm-hmm. that was, they were the only group of people who were had the, them and the Asians were the only group of people who would could be traced back to the Neanderthal, which was seen as a different, more aggressive, more violent species of human. And in your opinion, does that lineage impact upon current behavior?
Does the lineage of Neanderthal man cause them to be more hostile? Is that the devil's question?
Yes, yes.
We're taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad that they came from us, and they did have an experience when they lived in a cave for a while. That is their history, not our history. And they have a tendency to be violent, as we already know their history says that. Whether or not it's connected to that or the process it took to make them is a discussion that we would have to have at another time, because that's a long conversation. I'm sure the minister has tapes on it because he's spoken about everything else. So you might be able to check on NOI.org and see if the minister ever spoke about how Europeans were made and how it's affected them and their behavior.
Excellent. Last question. In 1970, 83% of the American, you talked about this a little earlier, but I wanted to kind of touch on that. 83% of the American population were whites of European descent. By 1980, it dropped to 80%. By 1990, it dropped to 75%. As we sit in 2018, the Caucasian population of the United States is at 63%. Okay, that means that there was a 40% drop in that population. The 20% drop in 40 years. If you double that, that's a 40% drop in 80 years, okay? The only other group to rival that were the Native Americans, where there was such a drastic drop in population. Now, is there, in your opinion, their underlying fear of being, and if you remember that North Carolina march, their chant was, "We will not be replaced," if you remember that.
Yes, I remember that.
Is this an underlying issue, in your opinion, of integration?
Really, it's more of it's an issue with reproduction. Because I remember when I was in college, and this is a while ago, they were having an issue with their reproduction even then. At that time, I think they were saying that for every death, there was a birth.
Yeah.
Now it's gotten so bad that they're burying more people than they're having. So it was really about them and their inability to reproduce. And I want to note that when I was watching that clip, I never heard them say anything about black people. They were talking about Jews in particular. So I don't know, you know, you would have to speak to them to find out why they were chanting about Jews. I never heard them say anything about black people. It was just implied that they were talking about us. But I think at some point they're going to have a conflict based on how polarized this nation is. And at some point they may move to a civil war. Especially
you really think that?
I really do, because when we, my undergraduate degree is political science. And any time you have such the polarization that you have in this country, if those issues are not resolved, it can become a violent issue. Because it's like me and you having a debate and we're arguing, and the argument becomes more heated and more heated. If no one steps in and intervenes, sooner or later, somebody's going to get upset, and it might go into a physical altercation. So I can see that as I'm looking at the news and I'm looking at what's going on. I can see that it may become a violent situation, because you got to remember, there are people who love Trump. There are people who are trying to get rid of Trump. I can see how if that's not handled properly, that can become a situation where there's bloodshed.
You know, I want to say that I'm going to jump in here. You know, I didn't necessarily want to talk about that subject, but let me say this in reference to what you're saying. I fully agree with what you just said, Sister Lorraine, because you see too many. I just read an article 2 weeks ago. They asked Carter, former President Carter, who was a Democrat, about Trump. And he said that if it was up to me, I would not try to move to impeach him. See, mm-hmm. white folks know that history, well, put it this way, we should know that history repeats itself and our experiences here should dictate things that we should do. We could see that if they moved, and I'm just using a hypothetical, if they moved to impeach Trump, That would, but basically, just like you said, start a civil war here among Europeans.
Yep. I agree.
Because you can see it. You can see some of the stuff that they've been doing so far. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, incidentally, something that you said, you talked about Jimmy Carter, and something that Sister Muhammad said earlier, that the party affiliation makes really no difference because each party carries out the same agenda. Mm-hmm. People may not notice, but when Jimmy Carter was governor of Georgia, guess who was his lieutenant governor? Segregationist Lester Maddox, of all people. So what does that tell you?
Yeah. Well, you know what? He had some policies that were questionable, too, Mr. Carter. I think it was Brzezinski. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He had a policy where he wanted to ensure that the blacks of different, blacks from the continent, blacks from the Caribbean, and blacks that were here the longest would never become a united front.
Wow.
So they've always had schemes and plots and plans, but we're looking at the smiling faces and the pats on the back, but we're not looking at the policies that they're writing.
And the major thrust of that, and y'all are pushing it into the geopolitical thing, because the concern was that the black world, you know, when you're talking about that period of Carter, was coming together trying to create what they called the new economic international order, which because to get it out from under, from what you had mentioned, Sister Muhammad, what occurred during the Berlin conference of, you know, which where the Europeans decided to carve up those, not just Africa, but also the Caribbean, you know, recolonize the Caribbean and South America. But by the 1950s, during the time of the civil rights, then those countries were said that they were recognized that they wanted to, again, take, they didn't want to be integrated in the Western. They wanted to pull out. And that's when they created the non-aligned conference and also that new international economic order. And the civil rights era falls right into that. The civil rights era, what's going on in South Africa. So what you have is the black world is saying, we're no longer going to be a part of this here construction that you created and made moves. And by the time Carter come in, really Nixon, Reagan, they're now trying to create ways, taking the money off of the gold standard, consolidating, you know, creating the structural adjustment loans, where these countries now are borrowing money and they're playing one against the other again. They know they can't do it militarily because they just lost in Vietnam. So right. This is a bigger issue than just, you know, raise what you raise and how it all comes together about them being a minority, not just in the United States, but a minority in the world who have subjugated the majority of people of color who now wants to come out from under.
Most of the war that they're fighting now is really to maintain colonialism and neocolonialism.
Carl, I want to thank you for joining us this evening.
Well, can I ask this one last question?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I promise. And I'm very interested in other people's opinion. That's why I'm asking these questions. In your opinion, what do you think it was the most devastating impact on African Americans or black people of integration?
What's been the most devastating?
Yes. Ooh,
that would be very difficult because it's like each area builds on the other. Because once you go into integrate, I'm a product of integrated school. And that itself was very problematic. And then you move from that system to the next system. So I personally don't even know if I can even pick a worse, because I think that they kind of like the one bad experience builds on to a next bad experience.
That's an excellent answer. That's an excellent answer. Thank you. Thank you, all three of you. It was fantastic talking with you.
Thank you for your call. Let's go to 602. Sister Muhammad, you still got a few minutes to stay with us?
Yes, I do.
Let's go to 602, area code 602.
Yes, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard and Sister Mohammed. Good evening. This is Brother Marcus from Memphis.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, brother. You know, I agree with what the sister say. You know, we got to move out of here. You know, and given the history of this country, like I said, the last 50 years, we're looking at the statistics now and see the condition of our people. What do this question to the sister? What do you think in reference to a dynamic program of Garveyism, Pan-Africanism? Because as we know, you know, Garvey's program, he, you know, when, you know, the 30s, he had those ships, or in the 20s, he bought those ships. What do you think about picking up from where Garvey left off, all right? And another man by the name of Carlos Cooks, who picked up the baton after Garvey, but he took the religious element and the political element out of it. As you were saying, that we have to organize around race and economics. But what do you think about a dynamic program of Garveyism in this time now? Because as you stated, there is an impending civil war coming. And as Garvey said, he said, when the elephants fight, the grass gets trampled. And we are the grass in this society. So what do you think about a dynamic program of Garveyism? And I'll hang up and hear your response. Thank you, sister.
I do remember studying something about Marcus Garvey when I was in college. I don't remember all of it, but anything that's economic, anything that we have to do that we can get ourselves moving, that we can develop our people, that we can provide jobs, I don't have an issue with. Because we can't have solid family foundation with so many of our men unemployed.
Okay.
And I think I read an article where it said 70% of the black men are working in fast food restaurants, those who are employed. And you know those are not living wage jobs. They can barely survive themselves. So how are these men going to have family life? So any economic program that we can move forward on is good. I know that I'm in the Nation of Islam. We're pooling our resources. We're working, you know, to get ourselves, you know, economically strong for our people. So, that's one organization that's doing something. But any black organization that will do something with the money besides buy a car, besides buy a house, besides buy a yacht, you have to put the people first. You're not a good shepherd if you're eating and the people are starving.
Let's go to, let's get one more in here. Let's go to 215.
How you doing, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Hey, Brother Richard.
Hi, how you doing now?
And my dear sister, I admit I tuned in a little late. What's your name, my dear sister?
Lorraine Muhammad.
Sister Lorraine?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Sister Lorraine Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, my dear sister.
Assalamu alaikum, sir.
Yeah, I'm honored to talk. I'm a member of the Nation of Islam myself, and I'm, you know, student at Arab Elijah Muhammad and his great minister, Minister Louis Farrakhan, and I appreciate you referenced the minister earlier when you talked about how, you know, when you went into the origin of the Caucasian.
But do me a favor, Joe. If you, because if you didn't catch the synopsis of the program, it might be a little unfair. I'll hold you over. We'll bring you on. Okay. I'll hold you over till after the break. Just stay with us.
Sure, no problem. No problem, Elliot.
All right. Sister Muhammad. I want to listen. I would encourage all of our listeners to get the book, Black Integration, a Failed Social Experiment. You can go to Sister Muhammad's website. I think she has it on her site.
My site is if you're going to want to wholesale the book, it's a 10 book minimum.
Okay.
If you're going to buy the book just for yourself, then you can go to Amazon again.
Okay, and I think I saw it on Barnes & Noble also. I think I did.
Yeah, it's probably in Barnes & Noble as well.
Yeah, I think that this book should be used in reading clubs because I know some of our folks, and I'm aware of some of our listeners that have reading clubs. It should be a conversation in reading clubs, in your churches, in your mosque, in your social groups. These things need to be discussed because it's alternatives. I mean, we've been on this treadmill of integration now for over 50 years, and you're like on a treadmill. Your feet is moving fast, but we ain't going anywhere. And what I also like about the book, Richard, and I shared it with you, that at the end of all of these things, all of the social indicators, the statistics that are quoted, at the end, the conclusions and suggestions at the end of the book as far as what we should do, because, I mean, Sister Muhammad pointed these things out in her research, but she's not the be-all and end-all. She don't know where we need to go, but I think we as a collective can determine where we need to go. And, and it's areas in the book of, for not only her conclusions, but also suggestions. Go ahead, Richard. I didn't mean to cut you.
No. I agree.
Yeah, and listen, I just want to thank you for being with us. Thank you for sharing. The door is always open for you to come back and expand on this topic or other topics, because I know that when you're an author and you're a researcher, you're not limited to just one book. You're doing other things. You probably got one in the pipeline now as we speak.
I'm thinking of a few, actually.
Okay, good. Again, Sister Muhammad, I want to thank you for being with us, and I'll reach out to you. Reach out to you again soon.
All right.
Peace.
Peace.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, for the time we have left, we'll kick around a couple of issues that happened locally, Richard. We got a caller holding over, and I'm going to bring him in. Interesting discussion. Before we break, interesting discussion, Richard, on this topic of integration. The book is very interesting. I would, again, suggest our listening audience to get the book, Black Integration, a Failed Social Experiment. And look at the things that she asserts in the book. Factual evidence, not just somebody's personal opinion. Look at the facts and then make your own decisions. Some of our people, and Jay talked about it earlier, some of our people get caught up in imagery. In fact, that's why they do it. That's why they put a lot of this stuff on the television. You see blacks with all this money, and blacks running around and throwing money up in the air and doing all kind of silly stuff. Blacks with whether it's the Oprahs, the Harveys, the others, that's not the norm. That's not black folks. You see what's happening in these cities, the unemployment spiraling out of control, the joblessness, the underemployment, the poor education, schools closing in a lot of these urban areas, and children being stuffed into business making entities like these charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
Cities being poisoned, water supply in black areas being poisoned, nothing being done about it politically, even if a state full of black elected officials, nothing seems to be done. It's like their hands are tied. We got to do better than this. And it includes some of the things that that Sister Muhammad asserts in her book.
Mm. Is the ammunition to be able to make the argument, not necessarily to others, but to ourselves in relationship to the urgency, in relationship to what we have to do or what we should be doing. Not as a means of saying, you know, I versus you, but as a means of how do we get to where we can be able to produce greater than the sum of our individual parts. I think I'm really always, you know, this whole discussion, this series we had, because even with Jared Ball talking about the current mission, series of discussion we've had around the integration is like really, and the feedback from the listening audience is really kind of shaped the historical references and the institutional activity that is going on to address the next 50 years. It's not necessarily what we have to do. It's just how do we make what we're doing stronger? And that is, it does come down to what she said, separation, and separation shouldn't be seen as some physical thing more than, as what I keep hearing everyone say, and we had Dr. Fox on, separation is a mental position.
Yeah,
it's a psychological position, and it's a value position. And we don't have to get into other people and their values, whether they want to assimilate or not, because that'll come to us. Because one thing in this history has shown us, Elliot, you know, that out of this discussion, that I, it just reinforces for me, history has shown us those of us who want, whether we call it sovereignty, nationalism, or separatism, or to be left alone, when we take those positions and we have spokespersons that project that, then there's someone else that'll come and say, no, we can't have that. We can't have you do that. Even when there's no threat to them, they say, we can't have you do that.
Yeah, listen, we've talked about it on several of the topics on this program, Richard. It starts in the mind first. We can separate our body. I could take my body somewhere else to another country or whatever, but if I got a sick mind, if I got a colonized mind, if I got a mind full of self-hatred, I'm taking that with me. It needs to start in the mind first.
Yes.
Then the body will follow. But it has to start in the mind, and we can start that process right where we are, right here. It has to start right here. That's where things are happening. That's where we are. So that mind reclamation, that new paradigm, however you want to term it, it has to start right here. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll kick a few topics around before we start winding things down. Time for Awakening. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
I think you'll find, sir, that there will come a time when black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think for themselves as other humans are intellectually independent enough to think for themselves, then the black man will think like a black man, and he will feel for other black people. And this new thinking and feeling will cause black people to stick together. And then at that point, you'll have a situation where when you attack one black man, you are attacking all black men. And this type of black thinking will cause all black people to stick together. And this type of thinking also will bring an end to the brutality inflicted upon black people by white people. And it is the only thing that will bring an end to it. No federal court, state court, or city court will bring an end to it. It's something that the black man has to bring an end to himself.
And leaders, you administrators, you teachers, you leaders, you are the worst. No cowardly, punctified leader will lead this new generation of young black men and women. Your day of leading them is finished. You can't feel it? When you talk to young people, you can't feel that you're missing them? Parents, you can't feel when you're talking to your children that this is a new generation and they don't want to hear your compromising talk? Did you hear them in Ferguson tell Jesse, get the hell out of here? You ain't no leader. I was hurting for my brother because Jesse worked hard for our people. But time has moved on. And what was good yesterday ain't no good at all today. So either you become a new vessel so that new wine can be poured into the old wine. For your day of leading our people is over, and it will never come back to you again.
Damn it, we're still in the land of our bondage. We're still in the land of captivity. We're still a slave to the Democratic Party. Still a slave to the Republican Party. You can't even see a Freedom Party. You don't see it. You're a slave. I'm a slave. And unless we admit that we are slaves, then we can never get free. Never get free.
Who put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years, and they're all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last, because you're a chump. A political chump.
down so you could see that the government of America has been planning our demise. Any members of Congress here, any members of the civil rights movement that are here, you love this nation. You've suffered every indignity to make America better, that she might be great. And every time you forced her to make a law that was in our favor, they came right behind that law with skill and chicanery to make the law of non-effect.
When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating her citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And again, I want to thank our guests that spent a good portion of the program with us this evening. Researcher and author, Sister Lorraine Muhammad. The book, Black Integration, A Failed Social Experiment. Pick it up. Interesting read, and it can start the critical discussion among some of the gathering places where we talk about things and, important things that we need to talk about. I don't want to get back into standing on the soapbox talking about some of the things that we do on Sundays and Wednesdays when we meet in places of spiritual enlightenment. But some of these topics need to be talked about because our people are affected by them every day, and we need to have critical discussions on what we need to do to move our people forward. Richard.
Yes, sir.
Just want to reflect on some of the things going on locally that hit the news, national news. Two brothers, young brothers, going to a well-known coffee place, and wait a minute, I'm getting a little. Is that that must be you in the background? Okay, they go into a well-known coffee place for a meeting. They sit there. I don't think they ordered any coffee, but it's plenty of white folks that go into those same places. They sit down with their computers or their tablets or whatever, and they sit there and they do what they have to do. That's what the places are there for. That's what I thought. I don't drink coffee. Then all of a sudden,
I'm a coffee drinker. I'm a Starbucks person.
All of a sudden, the police are called, and he's been arrested. No apparent reason. just that the management, I guess, seen two black, and they wasn't young. You know, they have a fear about some of the young boys congregating. These are two grown men. And I don't care whether they were boys. Well, I guess you wouldn't have young boys going to the coffee place, but maybe nowadays you do. I don't know. But you got two grown men sitting in a place waiting on a meeting, and here comes the cops. And the thing about it, somebody that was filming it, they were meeting a white guy. The white guy that came there to meet with them came inside and, hey, what's going on? What are you doing? Now, and they still arrested the two men. And then you hear, it don't matter whether these guys are white or black, but it happens that you got a black commissioner here in Philadelphia. He comes on and immediately he takes the police side, which is expected. But sometimes you get sick of this stuff with the people that look like you giving excuses for these people harassing black people. I mean, just come on, man. Richard, let me bring our caller in that's from Philadelphia area. Because I know he wants to weigh in. He couldn't talk. He get tuned in late. He didn't hear the discussion with our guest. But I'll bring him in now. Let's go to 215.
Hey, Brother Ali.
Hey, sir.
Listen, hey, Brother Richard.
I know you heard what's going on in Philadelphia locally.
Oh, no doubt.
The two men.
Before I do that, Ali, I'm glad you asked. I'm sorry I was able to. I got tuned into a little late, but I'm going to definitely get her book and stuff, man. Which is called Black Integration, a Social Experiment.
Yeah.
I'm going to definitely get the book and stuff, man. Because, like I said, the sister was dynamic, man. For the portion I heard of this sister, she was dynamic. And I hope y'all have her on again and stuff. But I will definitely get the sister's book and stuff. And, like I said, I was glad she referenced Minister Farrakhan about the origin of the Caucasian. Because, like I said, so many of our people, that's why we go through what we go through, because we don't understand the mentality or the nature of the people that we're dealing with. And a clear example of that is what you're talking about now, the situation at the coffee shop, you know? I don't even want to say their name because I don't want to get them no good.
Yeah, that's why I said a coffee shop. I didn't say their name, yeah.
Right. And like Brother Richard, I'm not going to say yes, but I've been there before. And most of the ones I've been into, the Caucasian that's been in there, they have been nice and stuff. I mean, I ain't going to sit there and throw them under the bus because these bigots that did this, what they did down there today. But, you know, but the point is, you know, they need to be held accountable for their racist actions. But see, again, Brother Elliot, it ain't got to the point, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, that.
Now wait a minute, Joe. Hold on a second. Okay. It showed, because somebody was taking the video with their cell phone, it showed that these guys got up and, you know, they were handcuffed and they walked out. Now, just say, for example, because, listen, if it was me in there, and I'm just using myself as an example, I'm sitting there waiting for somebody that I'm going to meet with, and here come the cops talking about get up and they put your hands behind your back. I might not be like those guys that just put my hands behind my back because I'm not doing anything. What the hell are you coming in here harassing me for? So it might be some kind of incident. But I'm just saying now, the reason I'm saying that, because we can go back and forth with this, but I'm using that to dovetail into my next issue, which you can kind of blend them together. You got a guy on this football team here, the Eagles, that the Eagles just signed. They traded for him, in fact. He came from the Carolina Panthers. It mentioned that he was evidently he left the practice facility because they said he was over there right off Broad and Patterson, getting ready to get on the highway. And he was pulled over to the side. They said he was asleep in the car. Now, if this guy's a professional player, he was near the practice facility, so he might have just left. He might have been he just got on his team. So it stands to reason the guy might have been working out or whatever. The police see him pulled over to the side, sleep in the car. Now, I'm stressing the part about sleep in the car because if he was high on drugs, they would have plastered that all over the news.
No question about it.
So evidently there wasn't no drugs involved. So they, instead of waking the man up or tap on the glass if he was blocking the entrance or whatever, say, you know, you fell asleep or whatever. They harassed this guy where he got out and was belligerent, they said. So in response to that, he's tased. And then they said they found a gun in the car. Okay, the man's a professional athlete. A lot of these professional athletes, I don't care who it is, they carry a gun.
Sure.
So, I mean, this whole thing of harassing these black men, You don't have to be doing anything. See, that's why our people got to come up with a way where we're going to deal with this. Because those two incidents could have easily meant that somebody could have been shot and killed.
And killed, exactly. Well, see, Brother Elliott, you know I told you and Richard on many occasions, I said, if we could talk to some of these professional athletes and entertainers, see, a lot of them, as you know, Brother Elliott, Richard, not all of them, but many of them, well, let's put this, but let me safely correct myself, I would say a decent amount of them has white man agents, white managers. Is it safe to say that?
Mm-hmm. I think so, yeah. Okay. You're absolutely
exactly.
Right.
All right. And I say all that to say this, Elliot. When I say that, Elliot Richard, what I mean from this standpoint is that if we could talk to some of these brothers and sisters that's in the entertainment and sports world, a lot of them, you'd be surprised, a lot of them probably had white racist cops put guns to their head and stuff when they've been stopped driving or whatever the case may be. But see, a lot of them, you may never have heard, never heard about it because their white agents tell them, oh, no, I'll take care of it. I call my friend on the police department. I call my friend FBI because you don't want that stuff to become racial. You understand what I'm saying, Brother Elliot and Richard? So we may never know about a lot of these incidents that's happened with these. Some of you may not know about them after they get finished playing football or whatever sport or entertaining, singing, whatever. Then after they careers winded down, then they'll finally come to the write a book or whatever. Say, yeah, back when I was playing for the Section 6 team, these white cops threw me on the ground, put guns in my head, but I didn't come forward to the public because my agent, who happened to be Jewish or Caucasian, whatever, he told me, you don't want that bad publicity. So I didn't even say anything back then. You know what I mean? So I'm quite sure that if those incidents happen to these high-profile and even some of the lower-profile black athletes and entertainers more often than we think. You know what I mean? I think it happens more often than we think. But see, you know, Brother Ellen Richard, when we played that clip of Brother Malcolm, because you've noticed how similar Dr. King and Malcolm sound when Dr. King was saying no law, no state law, whatever is going to make the black man show his manhood. He's going to have to reach deep within himself to do it. Well, Malcolm basically said the same thing too about when you trash or go against one black person, the other blacks gonna stick together. It's gonna become a time where the Negro gonna wake up to that. And so basically, Brother Malcolm and Brother Martin was basically saying that they might have said it in a slightly different way, Elliot and Richard, but it was basically saying the same thing. If black folks gonna rise to the levels of humanity and self determination, it's gonna have to be done by us. It ain't gonna be done by no white man, state law, federal law, city law. It's gonna have to come within the strong black man and black woman. That's why they go back to what you just said, Elliot. You know, our people gotta rise up and get this stuff that's happening at that coffee shop. What happened to brother at the on the side of the road? This stuff has got to stop, man. We cannot continue to go on into the 21st century beyond with this stuff still happening with black men. You know, you can't, a black man is shopping while black. The brother got shot in the Walmart a couple of the other year just looking at the rifle display. You can't drive while black, shopping while black. And I saw the documentary last summer at the church called, you know, A Walking While Black. You know, Love is the Answer, that was sponsored by the NAACP. And I'm saying to myself, damn, a brother can't walk. I mean, they show actual incidents across America that was actually filmed where brothers was walking to their cars or just walking down the street, just taking a casual stroll, Elliot and Richard, and some racist white cop come up there and harass them. You know what I mean? I mean, damn, a brother can't even walk down the street. I mean, this is how crazy it is in this country for us, man. So this delusion that we live in ain't about some integration, what Sister Muhammad was saying, and what you and Elliot have expanded on many times, Brother Richard. I mean, it's a fallacy, man. These people, integration has brought us nothing but pain and suffering, and that's why I said on the show Friday, I said when that's Miss Duckett, who's the daughter of the great Negro League player Marlon, Mr. Marlon Duckett, God rest his soul, like she says, our people don't realize the economic impact the integration had on black businesses. Besides, you know, it killed the Negro Leagues, which was an economic impact. But beyond that, the economic impact that it had on black businesses and stuff from hotels to restaurants all throughout America, whenever these black players would come to these cities and play and stuff like that, you know, they provide economic boom for the black businesses in those communities and stuff, you know. And see, the white man, the devil, he knew how good these brothers was, because I'm going to use one of their old icons, this exact quote from Babe Ruth. one of the white icons. He said out of his own mouth, I think he told Satchel Paige, one of them brothers back then, he said, boy, it's a good thing they don't, because they had a thing they called barnstorming, where they would play against these teams like the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Giants, all of them. And Babe told one of the great players, I think it might have been Satchel Paige or whatever, I can't remember who exactly who it was, but he told him, he says, man, it's a good thing that they don't let y'all guys play because y'all would kick our ass. Now, they would beat the hell out of them white boys. These white boys would have been some of the best out there, the Ted Williams, the Babe Ruth, and all of them. But them brothers would whip their behinds the majority of the time when they played. See, the people that ran Major League Baseball, they knew how good these brothers was. You know what I mean? And, mm-hmm. and when you look at Jackie Robinson, Elliot Richard, now, Jackie, today is Jackie Robinson there around the league. Now, as good as Jackie was, and you know Johnny, you know you have been a close friend of Johnny's like I am, Johnny Sample's brother, Elliot. Johnny said many times, and you have other players, the Negro League players said it, Jackie Robinson was far from being the best. You had a whole bunch of brothers back then was better than Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson was great, but it was better than him. But they chose Jackie because they felt as though he could take white folks' abuse. You know what I mean? And of course, you know, he did that, and, you know, and his wife, Miss said that she believed that caused Jackie an early death, because Jackie was a fighter, and he had to hold all that in, all the indignities he suffered, and that's why he developed diabetes, because Jackie Robinson was a healthy man growing up. He had to hold all that anger and bitterness in, and it wound up killing him and stuff. That's why he only, when he died, he was only 53 years old, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so you see clearly what black men have to endure, and women endure in this country, and still enduring now, because like you said, Elliot, and it's no lie, that coffee shop that you, I don't want to mention the name, if I mention the name by mistake, I apologize. Hey, like you said, Brother Elliot, I've been seeing people, white folks, in them places all downtown and wherever. And like you said, Brother Elliot, I have seen white men and women come off the street. And it's the honest to God truth, they'll come off the street. They'll sit down and pull out a newspaper. They'll sit up there because they got Wi-Fi in there. They'll sit up there with a laptop and sit down and don't order nothing. Just sit there and just drink. And nobody bothers them, nobody. But as soon as a black man do, all of a sudden he's trespassing. He's a criminal. I mean, this stuff is outrageous, Brother Elliot. And like you said, only by the grace of God, this thing didn't escalate to them brothers probably being shot or something by them racist bastard cops. And like you said, Richard Ross, and look, I try to get a man some benefit, but I was definitely disappointed. I'm going to tell him that, too, when he's next time he's on his...
You was disappointed in what?
I'm supposed to tell it.
You was disappointed in what?
In Ross' comments.
Oh, I'm not disappointed. I expect that out of them. I expect
I do
that.
Do too, Elliot, but I was...
I'll be shocked if any of these elected officials, and I think it's one that's over that area.
Right.
Yeah, that's over that area.
Okay,
I'll be surprised if they have any strong comments to make in reference to it.
Right?
I think that Richard mentioned that one of the guys, local guys, Bilal Qayyum, one of them, was talking about the people not going in there.
Mm-hmm. Right, the protests for the Black Lives Matter, they had today. Mm-hmm. I believe it was today.
Yeah, okay. So I guess that means Brother Asa or somebody was down there. But anyway, listen, if our people want to, because Asa already was up at the other spot. If our people want to drink coffee, let them go up there to Mark Lamont
Uncle
Hill's
Bobby.
Place. Go up to Uncle Bobby's. They could sit in there,
have
a meeting, drink coffee, read a book, do whatever. Give Uncle Bobby your dollars. The hell
I
with
agree.
A damn Starbucks. They need to go in the place. They need to wait till nighttime and throw a brick through the window. Well, I ain't going to say that. Somebody might get in trouble. But the hell with them places.
But I understand you're
drink coffee at home.
We got to stop begging and pleading.
Well, I can say that because I ain't no coffee drinker, so I can take it or leave it.
Right. No, but what I'm saying, Ellie, you I understand your anger and sentiment because we have got, like Brother Michael Kors said on his show today, he echoed your sentiments. He said we have got to stop going to these begging and looking for apologies from these racist bigots and stuff. When they treat us bad, don't give them your dollar. You know, this is bottom line. Let them fall on their face and stuff. Don't give them your dollars. I mean, we the only people that consistently do that. We'll sit there and keep going to these places. I'll never forget Mary Mason and stuff says years ago back when she was on the old HAT. I'm going back 25 years ago or so. Elliot and Richard, this, as a black man of 56 years old and turned 57 this July, it used to pain me when I heard black folks call Mary's show and they would be saying about, oh, Mary, you know, I went up to the mall up in the Chamonix or whatever, or Cherry Hill, and a white guard followed me all over the store. The white girl, when she rung up my purchase, she threw in and touched my hand. She threw my money on the counter. So this went on and on. This was always during the holiday season. But Mary said, why you keep going there for? You know, I don't have, and the Lord knows I have issues with Mary on a lot of things, but a broken clock is right twice a day. Mary said, why the hell you keep going and giving these racist people your money? You keep saying how they treating you like that. Why don't you, Mary would tell us, why don't you go to the black stores in West Philadelphia or the vendors out there and get your stuff? Why do you keep going to these racist malls and these people treating you so bad? You know what I mean? We're like a glutton for punishment, man. You know? I mean, stop and think about the insanity of it all, man. You know? We suffer all kinds of indignity just so we can sit there and show some white man or woman that credit card. So you think they don't press these crackers because you show them your credit card. I got my Visa. I got my debit. I got my MasterCard. You know what I mean? Well, I tell you, sometimes we crazy as hell, man.
Yeah.
You know, we are crazy, Richard, as hell sometimes.
What do you say, Richard?
Go ahead, Richard.
I'm trying to, because as this unfolds, and I'm a frequent, patron to that coffee shop.
You know, and I've been there before. Let me interrupt you for a second. I'm not going to front on this phone. Now, I've been there many times. Like I said at the outset, I've been to many. I'm across the city, and most of the Caucasians have treated me nice. I'm not going to say I haven't been in there. But go ahead, Rich. Let me interrupt your comment.
I think the thing that bothered me has just come up, on my side, I was getting flack because there's some around me who believe that I shouldn't even be patronizing, and for various reasons, the economic reasons, race reasons, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I do it anyway.
Right.
But the thing that got me as I seen the incident unfold is the challenge, because I didn't hear, immediately people came out about boycott mm-hmm. The coffee shop, right? So here I am, I'm already now, that's my first stop early in the morning. I'm talking about 5:30 in the morning. That's my mm-hmm. first stop in the morning. So here now you're telling me to boycott, which I agree, right?
Mm-hmm.
But here, now I don't know if this is my addiction to white, my addiction to caffeine, mm-hmm. but here, I'm now conflicted, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I agree with, in principle, what is being called for the reason. And even though that particular franchise or company, we know that they only place themselves in particular communities. So mm-hmm. that's a strategic business position. And here, within the community I live in, which is now under gentrification. So I'll probably see one pop up after mm-hmm. it gets to a certain point. But the community I'm living in, there is no coffee shop where I feel where I can go and do UNI work, or I can go and do the African American Museum work and drink my brew, mm-hmm. Or go to on my way to going to work. So here, what my principle being in support of is in conflict with my behavior,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is what I guess would be, and now, I'm kind of, because what's understood is that once we recognize or hear the call that these kind of acts happen, we should be responding with nobody. We don't need to have no protests or mm-hmm. no Balea Qayyum or regardless what a black police commissioner, we would know automatically that we're going to go to, is it Uncle Bobby?
That's cafe, correct.
And the thing, even with that, and it's the, it's a bookstore, it's a comic book store owned by a coffee shop owned by a black female in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Amalgam bookstore.
Okay.
And
where's that at, Richard?
Yeah, that's in the north. That's in the Frankfurt, in the Frankfurt section.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Where I am in South Philadelphia, and I don't know, I can give the general audience the understanding of this conflict, right? Where to go to Uncle Bobby, which is in the Germantown section, which is
not too far from me,
you know, which is mm-hmm. far away from where
right
I am,
to you, you got to go across town,
or mm-hmm. go to Frankfurt, which is far away from me.
Right.
I have no option, maybe because of the position of integration, where
right.
the black community doesn't have a place, the types of coffee shops
where I could be able to go to do just to socialize, cause, you know, or just to feel, be outside of my home in my community.
You make a good point. You make some good
points. So this is the kind of conflict that I personally am recognizing. And I'm wondering how many, as I was being challenged on this, I was wondering how many people have this individual conflict. I mean, that's different than you're not conscious at all, that you're not, you know, you're not aware at all, that you're conscious and aware, and still you have to overcome this here behavior. Now, for some, they may be strong enough to be able to just do that. And that was, I ain't going to use a Elliot. I'm not going to use Time for Waking for my therapy session. I guess I got to go. Go to good Dr. Fox and go to his class.
Rich, I appreciate your candor. Rich, I appreciate your honesty and candor, Richard. That's refreshing. So my hair, because you show what a principled person you are. Like I said, I appreciate your honesty and candor about that, because it could be a dilemma for somebody because of the distance that you're at. I'm like Elliot, I can take coffee or leave. I drink some every now and then. And like I said, when I go in that place, that I want to mention the name. I never went in so much for the coffee. I just would like I like the chocolate. Like, I'm a chocolate person. I go in and get the hot chocolate or whatever like that. I'm more of a chocolate person. With coffee, I can take it or leave. I might get a cup here and there when I need to stay awake and stuff like that. But I understand what you said. It could be a dilemma for some people and stuff, man. You know, because like you said, you're so far away from Uncle Bobby. If Uncle Bobby was down the street from you, Richard, you'd be in Uncle Bobby's every day.
Yeah, all the time. And you know the interesting thing of that, Joe and Brother Elliot, is that what's in the community that I'm in, and I don't know, and I'm with hopefully others who live in the same, having the same dilemma, but live in the same, where I notice whether I'm in South Philadelphia, North Philadelphia, or West Philadelphia, the coffee places, they're owned by Asians. So if I lived in those places and got up, and they're open at 5:30 in the morning. And I see people who live in the community, that's where they go to get their coffee.
Right. Even
to the laundromat. The Asians have that coffee pot, and they give them that coffee with their sugar. So here, when we're talking about the issue of looking at it, that you know that we need to spend our dollars with ourselves, knowing that we need to cultivate Black businesses. When these incidents come up, where we're constantly reinforced of this system and these particular type of people who work in this system, because I think that the person who called the police was just personally afraid of Black males.
Oh, no question about it.
It wasn't that what they did. They didn't do anything. They weren't homeless kind of people.
Exactly. They was decently dressed Black men, but because they Black men.
Well, I don't know necessarily know was it a fear of Black men. I think they just didn't want them in there because the place was loaded with white folks.
Sure,
so they couldn't have felt that the guys was going to jump on them because there's a bunch of white folks in there.
But that's where that racist mindset comes in.
Oh, certainly.
You automatically got that preconceived notion that this Black man is a threat, even though he hasn't did anything. Y'all familiar with Black Enterprise magazine, right? Graves Jr., the son of Earl, book they call him Butch. He's told about the incident, two incidents happened to him that he said that show him how with all his money, how he's not, how sometimes incidents that needs to, he stayed in the way, he was glad it happened because it kept him connected to the everyday Black man and stuff. Two incidents, real quick, I'll run them down for you. He said, well, this happened in Texas years ago. We was there for a conference. And he said he gets on the elevator. Now, mind you, Elliot and Richard, Earl Grey Jr. got money. His family was a wealthy Black family in this country. He could probably got enough money, he could probably buy a few hotels. So he in his four-class hotel, I think in Dallas, Texas, it might have been, or Houston, for this conference. He gets on the elevator with his $1,000 suit on, his Italian loafers, whatever, his briefcase, Rolex watch, all that good stuff. He gets on the elevator. He said these two white women, you know, and they're like, I guess, in their 40s, whatever, like that. He says he gets on there. You can see he's really dressed to the nines, right? Like, you know, he says they didn't stop them. He said they start clutching their pocketbook, you know, kept looking back at him like they was like he was going to sexually assault them or whatever like that. And he said it was making them feel so uncomfortable. He kept on looking back at him like he was going to do something to them. And so he said, wow. He said, you know, He's I could see about was have a pants hanging off of behind and the do rag. I could see him. He said, but the way I was dressed, for him to look at me like that, it was, he said, just really just brought him back to how things is for black people in this country. And then he told about another incident. I'll share this real quick. He said when the police pulled him over, they down in Florida. He was down there for some kind of event, and he says how to. He said, you know, he was dressed real nice, driving a nice rental car he had. He said the cops still, you know, told him to get out of the car, put his hands where they could see him, you know, talk real rough to him and everything like that. And he said, well, if they do this to me, and I'm Earl Grey, and Junior, he said, what chance do the average black man got who's just a regular black man, you know, everyday black working class black man? Here's again a man that's a millionaire two or three times over. So he said those two incidents was like a wake-up call to him to let him know that with all his money and his fame and all the stuff that his father and family did through Black Enterprise magazine, that, hey, at the end of the day, he's viewed as a threat by white America. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well.
And again, that's why I say, Elliot, so many of these black athletes in the town is, like I say, more than me, you and Richard would even imagine. They have been accosted by the police, but because, like I said, so many of them got white agents and white managers, they never tell the public what happened. I'm sure many of them have been probably brutalized by the police, but you may never know about it.
Mm, yeah, well.
You know? I mean, that's the reality of thinking. This is America. I'm in no illusion about this country, and that's why it just pains me. As you know, next month is Memorial Day. And again, for some of our, and I'm sure we all of our families, Elliot and Richard and stuff, we can find a family member that was in the military. I mean, that's pretty much all black folks. We can, whether it was a cousin, a father, an uncle, a brother, you know, whatever. You know, we can probably find a relative that was in the military. But I'll be, and again, if you want to honor that person because of their memory, not because they served this devil army, but because they deceased and you want to honor their memory, I can have no problem with that. But I'll be damned if I'm going to get on any radio station in town from the Awakening or any terrestrial station and talk about thank you for your service. Hell will freeze over first. When I honor, my father was in the Navy, so I honor my father's memory. My father died back in 75. He was in the Navy. He told me about the racism that he went through in the Navy. So I will honor his memory and any other loved one or either some, you know, ancestor that fought for our people, whether it be a Malcolm X, Elijah Muhammad, a Dr. King, a Sojourner to Truth, a Winnie Mandela. I will honor those people on Memorial Day. When that holiday comes in a month from now, I have no problem having a moment of silence or reflection on their lives. But I'd be damned if I'm doing it from a military standpoint. Why the hell I'm going to sit there and tell them some thank you for your service when they're killing our people left and right? I mean, the brother can't even go to a damn coffee shop without being accosted by these bigger cops. And you got a police commissioner who I want to believe is a decent man, but just don't have the damn courage to step up to the plate like a strong black man. It's just tell the truth and stuff. All you had to do was say, look, what happened was an unfortunate incident. He could have covered this behind both ways. I did say, look, what happened was an unfortunate incident. You know, the police may have thought they was doing the right thing, but I think they was wrong in how they approached this thing. You know, I'm not bashing my police department, but I think they should have handled it better and everything. This was a whole unfortunate incident that should have never had Ross said something like that. I could have gave a man the benefit of this, but to sit there, like you say, Elliot, and get that little handkerchief head, boot-licking answer like that. I mean, hell, the mayor came out strong, and he's white. And again, you can have issues with me, Kenny, and that's fine. He came out with a stronger statement than Ross did. You know, he said it was just pretty much racial. I mean, he supported the police, but he had enough heart and fortitude to say it was racial and everything, whereas the damn black police commissioner gonna sit there and tap dance all around it and stuff like that. I mean, that just kind of stuff, Elliot, is very, very disheartening, man. You know, I mean, he's a black man. He know what time it is. He know he got bigots on that police department. He even has said on terrestrial radio, he knows some racist element on that police department. So for him to sit there and act like that, you know, like that's something fraud from the, you know, from what's going on, it's very disconcerting, Elliot. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. One of our frequent callers and listeners to the program, Brother Otis, wrote in the chat room Ross's comments, and I'll read it for the listening audience. This is
sure.
The commissioner here in Philadelphia. He says, Ross, who is black, said police asked the men to leave three times, but they refused, and they were then arrested, but were later released after the company, the Starbucks company, elected not to prosecute. He said the officers did absolutely nothing wrong and were professional in their conduct towards the individuals, but got the opposite back. he did not mention the person who said that he was meeting with the man. As an African-American male, I am very aware of implicit bias. We are committed to fair and unbiased policing, Ross said. But he added, if a business calls and say, is somebody here and we no longer wish them to be in my business, officers now have a legal obligation to carry out the duties that, and they did just that. You asked a man to leave for what? For what reason?
And that's I like how you word it, Elliot. For what reason, Elliot? If I was going to stick with that statement, so that means I can go.
See, because if somebody say, "Well, I want them to leave because they're black," then by this law of the United States, you can't do that. So just saying that if a business want people out, then you got to do your duty as a police officer. That's bullshit. Excuse the expression.
And I like how you worded it, Elliot, because they got no legal ground to stand on. If the person's not doing anything wrong and they're not bothering nobody, why do they have to leave? You know what I mean? So you're right, Elliot, they have no legal leg, and Ross knows that. But see, he's trying to straddle the fence. See, often, too often, Brother Elliot, when black men get in these positions and stuff like that, they always feel like they got to straddle the fence and stuff like that. No, step up to the damn plate, Ross, and be a damn man. As a matter of fact, back when that incident happened with David Jones, remember when the cop shot David Jones last summer? Mm-hmm. I put Ross' feet to the fire on Sylvester radio station here in Philadelphia when Brother Phil used to do the show in the morning. Ross was his guest that day, and I called up, and he didn't get to my car because I was he took the one car, then after that he left, but he still heard me because Phil said he was still listening. I said, let me say this to Commissioner Ross if he's still listening. I said, it's not about liking him or disliking him. I said, it's not about that. I said, you can like somebody and still be against what they position they take. I said, to Commissioner Ross, we in the black community, we got to hold him accountable. I said, it's not about liking or disliking him. I said, he's the police commissioner. He got to do his damn job. I said, he know this white cop shot that brother in the back, shot that man in cold blood, and he had no reason to take that man's life. And I said, this man has a history of doing this white cop. I said, remember, he shot a black man a few years earlier and paralyzed this black man. I said, Ross need to do his damn job and fire this guy and stuff. And I'm not saying my comments alone, Ellen and Richard, made Ross's decision, but it was others that came, paid a similar call, not only on that show, but other shows. And what happens about 2 or 3 weeks later, Ross fires this cop. You know what I mean? Again, I'm not saying my call influenced him, but I'm just saying I just put his feet to the fire. I said, just do your damn job and fire this man. You know this man shouldn't be on the police department. You know what I mean? So that's my problem with black men. And it goes back, Elliot, to what you said a few minutes ago. You said something that was so profound. You said many of these cities that we have, with this large black pop, politicians in office, whether they be mayors, police commissioners, fire commissioners, or city council president, you say black, they act like they're damn, like you say, their hands is tied. They still, like they can't, like they're scared to go against the white man and get meaningful change for their people and stuff like that. Like you say, you got black people in Flint, Michigan, but you have to act like they're scared that the man, that black folks in Flint have clean damn water to drink and clean water to cook in and bathe themselves in. Like these niggas, like they're scared to death and stuff like that. And to me, Ellen and Richard, it all goes back to what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said. He said, if you're going to support a black politician, whether it be man or woman, you got to support one. And it's not no rocket science, Ellen and Richard. You got to support that individual, him or her, that is not afraid of the goddamn white man, as Dr. Khaled would say. They're not afraid of the goddamn white man, because that's what it comes down to. If a Negro, male or female, is scared of the white man and stuff, then the ball game is lost already before you even got up to the plate, the bat. The game is over with, man.
Yeah, well, listen, I'm going to tell this to you because we're going to start winding the program down. Cause,
okay, go ahead, Elliot.
Mm-hmm. Brother Richard, I know that we didn't kept Brother Richard over time.
Okay.
But listen, I want to say this.
I close with this real quick.
No. I want to say this to you before we leave.
Go ahead.
Because the number one black man on this football team here that walk around with a black glove, that used to walk around with a black glove and his clenched fist clenched or whatever. See, that's what I was saying before all this stuff happened about certain people need to be watched. Now, I didn't hear them go to him and ask him anything about this stuff going on with the defensive lineman who came from Seattle. Now you got a man that come from the practice facility, fell asleep in his car, and then get tased by the cops.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the comments here from the number one black man that represents black players in the league? The mm-hmm. media haven't went to him and asked him nothing.
Of course not.
And he ain't volunteered no comments. Mm-hmm. These guys ain't nothing but charlatans, man.
Mm-hmm. Now, I disagree with you when it happened because I said I think you was premature in your comments, and I tried to give him the benefit of the doubt. But time proved that you was right. And see, I always like to say I'm never that.
This team said they planned to release the guy. Now you release him based on what? Because he was tased by the police?
Well, you know, Brother Elliot, again. A black man don't get a fair shake.
Wait a minute. This guy is supposed to be one of the guys on the team that can at least call some shots. He's mm-hmm. one of the big ticket guys on this club.
Yeah, right.
He don't have nothing mm-hmm. to say in reference to it?
Of course not. But see, Elliot, what it comes down to, Elliot, like so this guy was a charlatan. Like so he was nothing but putting on a front the whole time. Remember the brothers out there in the 49ers, the brother Eric Davis. Remember he said he don't speak for us. Remember he said that, Elliot?
Yeah, you're talking about Eric Reed, I think.
He said Jacobs don't speak for us. They say he split from us. He on his own. We ain't dealing with that stuff he's dealing with. But again, Elliot, all a black man got to do, Elliot Rich, is just be accused, and that's it. Remember last summer when I was down in Dallas and I called you and Richard from Dallas, Texas, remember?
Yes.
All right. Well, as I was down there that time for my family reunion, because my cousin Vanessa lives in Dallas, I was watching the news on my TV in my hotel room in Dallas. The brother, who was a great punt returner, Lucky Whitehead and stuff, this brother was accused of breaking into a department store in Dallas and stuff. He was accused and stuff. He was arrested. And come to find out, the brother was innocent. It was somebody that looked like him. He wasn't even a perpetrator. Instead of the Dallas Cowboys, Jerry Jones and Jason Garrett saying, look, we made a mistake. Because even the white policeman said we made a mistake. We even know this man didn't do it. It was somebody just happened to look. Because he's like, right, he wear the, you know, cornrows and stuff or braids, and this guy happened to look like him. But but when you see him, the picture, you can see clearly it wasn't him and stuff. Once they enhanced the pictures, but bottom line, instead of Dallas, even the white press down in Dallas said, look, why don't y'all rectify this thing? Because they had cut the man off the team, kicked him off the team, everything. And he wound up signing with the Jets. But anyway, they said, won't you apologize, Jason Garrett, we made our decision, you know, and stuff, you know, we moving on from that. I mean, never once had the decency to say we did this man wrong. He was falsely accused. He was arrested. We kicked him off the team. We're going to rectify this, bring him back and apologize. Them two crackers didn't have enough fortitude to just step up to the plate and be a man about it. But see, this is how black folks treat in this country, Ellen Richard. You know, even when the facts prove that you're innocent, instead of them devils having the decency to sit there and say they're wrong, they stick by their guns. You know what I mean? Because when you're a black man in this country, I mean, the bigotry with these people, that's why I say you think you're going to sit there and change the nature of these people. And like the sister said about the integration of Sister Muhammad, this is who you're dealing with. This is these people's mindset, man. They
all
don't
right,
see you as a human being. They don't see you as a human being. And that's the bottom line. You can talk all the integration and singing and we shall overcome till the damn cows come home. You dealing with a devil, racist, sick mindset. That's their mindset they're going to have to Allah remove them from the face of this damn earth. And that's the bottom line.
Thank you for your call, man.
Thank you, Brother Elliot. Thank you, Brother Richard.
Peace.
I'm right now.
Richard, kept you overtime, man.
Now, when I go drag now,
oh, wait a minute.
I can't go to a coffee shop.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. All you got to do is get a double shot of coffee. Come on.
You know, I'm glad my friend Jay didn't get back on because I would have had to deal with that, too.
Well, make sure you got your computer and all out when you're sitting there because I don't want them to come in there and arrest you.
Hey.
Then we might have to bring Jay and everybody else down here to help get you out.
But it's all good. It's all good.
Boy. Listen, I want to let everybody know about the lineup tomorrow. And it starts out with African Perspectives with Brother Ushi at 11 a.m. tomorrow. 11 to 1 on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Later on that afternoon, you have Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed from 6 to 8. On Time for an Awakening. After that, Let's Buy Black 365.com Connect from 8 to 9 on Monday evenings on Time for an Awakening. Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank, Dr. William Rogers, will be opening things up. Interesting program he's even had, Richard. I don't know whether you've caught any of them. Very interesting programs. Dr. William Rogers, Black Reality Think Tank, on Tuesday evenings at 8 o'clock, 8 to 10, on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, you might have a tape delay or a tape program of Revive with Sister POC. She's in Africa right now, and she'll be there for the whole month. So I guess she'll have some exciting stories to share with the listening audience when she gets back. But her program airs on Wednesday evenings from 8 to 10. Thursday, Us Lifting Us, a Black Economic Development Program, is on 9 o'clock on Thursdays. And then Fridays, we're back with Time for an Awakening on Friday evenings at 8 o'clock. On Saturday, SST with Big Number 21, Troy Wilmore, is on. Saturday Sports Talk with Troy Wilmore is on Saturday mornings from 10 to 12 on Time for an Awakening. That's the lineup, Richard. And I'm going to let you go for this evening. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. Have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. Play such a small part of the thing that they'll soon be right at the heart of. My little Tommy, he said he wants to be a fireman.
blame the children. To save the children.